Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
Welcome to the Cress Welsing Institute of Psychiatry and Social Research. The Institute is a series of lectures focusing on one topic, and that topic is the system of racism, white supremacy. We respect all shades of black, but we are going to respect black because that is our power.
If you had a choice of colors,
keys to the colors,
which one would you choose, my brother?
For Dr. Francis Crest Wellson, 1935 to 2016. The Crest Theory of Color Conscious Confrontation are the keys to the colors of white genetic annihilation. As Queen Warrior, Scholar, Counter-Racist, Black Gold Pearl, she gave us the keys to unlock our love of self for a whole new world.
You see, people all over the non-white world have been programmed to want to be white.
Her color-conscious codification made her one of a special kind. Public enemy number one, a white psychoanalysis on the front line. The cause and effect of the iconic ISIS papers is the master key to decode the white psyche on the chessboard of white supremacy.
The issue is racism, white supremacy.
White fear rules in all areas of human life to the core. Economics, education, entertainment, labor, law, politics, religion, sex, and war.
You see, we are in a system of racism, white supremacy. The system is going to do everything possible to demean you and to destroy your self-respect. The issue is racism, white supremacy.
Fear of the future is nothing to simply be taken for granted. As a white minority, one-tenth of all the people on the planet.
We are the parent people on the planet. And we are the people who are maximizing our black self-respect.
Under the conditions of war, the love of black self-respect is key to counter the ungodly religion of racism, white supremacy. The theory of the ball games is a black self-conscious wake-up call. But the global minority says, don't be caught behind the eight ball.
See, that's why we always say, hey, what's happening? Because we don't know what's going on.
The cause and effect of the iconic ISIS papers is a master key to decode the white psyche on the chessboard of white supremacy.
The issue is racism, white supremacy.
The Crest Theory of Color Conscious Confrontation are the keys to the colors of white genetic annihilation. Keys to the colors.
See, Neely Fuller says, if you do not understand white supremacy, racism, what it is and exactly how it works, everything else that you think you understand will only confuse you.
Rest and peace.
There was no day.
Dr. Francis Crest Wellson.
Which rest you prefer to be right?
keys to the color.
If you had a choice of colors, which one would you choose, my brothers?
The issue is racism, white supremacy.
Context of white supremacy, Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Friday, March 18th, 2016. So I have been told today is Dr. Francis Cress Welsing's birthday. Wanted to make sure that we paid our respects right from the very beginning. With that, we will get started with another Chicago native. This is our book club, Miss Leonida McLean, A Foot in Each World, Essays and Articles by the Late Leonida McLean. We will go ahead and get started. This is audio segment number one, Context of White Supremacy.
January 15, 1984. Curious can't undo King's heroism. Today is the birthday of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr., in its way a holy day for blacks. Dr. King's heroism and power to stir remain with me and millions of other people of all colors who seek and work for goodness and justice, though they may never find it. The nonviolent teachings, the valor, the love of Dr. King remains as surely as the remembrance of the sight of him gesturing, enunciating, and rising up physically at the lectern as if to soar along with the crescendo of his awesome message. This is the first time this day has arrived with deserved national recognition, although the official federal holiday would not take effect until 1986 on the third Monday of January. After 15 years of oversight, Congress last October finally passed the legislation making Dr. King's birthday the 10th legal federal public holiday. The legislation was originally introduced within days of his assassination in April 1986. In death, as in life, the perseverance espoused by Dr. King ultimately frustrated his maligners. Yet one of their ringleaders, Senator Jesse Helms of North Carolina, could not let the matter come to a close without vilifying Dr. King as an action-oriented Marxist. Worse, Helms tried to impart some honor to his true intent by decreeing the cost of yet another paid holiday for federal workers. And most unforgivable, he sought to have the courts lift the seal on FBI bugs and wiretaps of Dr. King, shamelessly disregarding the family's desire and agreement with the government that they be sealed for 50 years. There is an issue on those tapes. It is, how solid are one's heroes? Curiosity would have you wonder, what is in them that is so spurious that would be so calamitous if revealed? What is suspected about the contents of the tapes already gives them negative inference, a legal term essentially meaning that the absence of proof that they are not damaging becomes the proof that they are. The tapes reportedly contain snippets revealing that the amazing marcher and preacher was also an amazing womanizer. I believe it was Jesse Jackson years ago who brushed aside the sexual innuendos with a remark to the effect that if indeed Martin could have done all that marching and all that preaching and still run around, he was surely a king. On this, his birthday, I respond with a similar, so what? Curiosity has me itching to know what is in the tapes, yet I respectfully grant the King family's right to and wish for privacy and perpetuity if necessary. Sources with even the slightest notion of the tape's contents warn that a revelation might undo King's image and perhaps some of his social good, that besides the embarrassment to his family, bigots would have cause to revel. But a crack in one's idol is not cause to smash it, to denounce it, and to turn away. Such is the price paid by public people in their private lives, or sometimes in their public lives, since the most fascinating twist on the story is that then Attorney General Robert F. Kennedy, who was perceived as having been in step with civil rights, authorized the eavesdropping. Senator Edward Kennedy, having to lower himself in acrimonious debate with Helms, defend his late brother. If he were alive today, he would be the first person to say it was wrong to wiretape Martin Luther King. And I think that, were Dr. King alive, he would be the first to forgive the authorization. Such was the manner of the public man in life, and such will he be throughout time. What Dr. King did publicly was to shame this nation into searching its conscience and giving to a people what should have been theirs anyway. What Dr. King did publicly was to shame this nation into searching its conscience and giving to people what should have been theirs anyway. He flung words so mighty they pierced the hardest hearts and brought about civil rights legislation. These are what will last. What he did in private will not. Not even on tape.
January 22, 1984. Rights Commission looks backward. Racial quotas were fine in the days when they were unwritten, unquestioned, understood to be whites 100%, blacks 0. Those percentages were simple, easy to maintain. But then blacks started complicating everything, calculating that they were 10% of the total American population and 40% or even 60% of municipality or school or voting age populations in some places. And so came the civil rights movement, which brought affirmative action and quotas. The former is a stated intent to take action to correct wrongs to some degree. Quotas are actual, verifiable numbers that are suggested or often demanded at very high decibels to get this nation to adjust the historical ledger that has listed blacks as liabilities rather than assets. Last week, the reconstituted U.S. Civil Rights Commission began looking at those figures and reverting to the old system of bookkeeping. By a vote of 6-2, the commission declared that the use of racial quotas in affirmative action programs by public employers was not the way to correct job discrimination. So what is? I can hardly wait for the commission's pronouncement that old-fashioned American freedom and sense of fair play will out over discrimination. That same old American freedom and sense of fair play that keeps blacks behind. The nonsense on quotas capped a week of policy reversals, absurdities, and outright heartlessness by the new but hardly improved commission. It took out affirmative action, bilingual education, busing, and other mandatory racial preferences, labeled as radical and the theory of paying women equally with men for comparable work, suggested discarding two studies already underway, one on how cutbacks in student financial aid affect colleges with black and Hispanic majorities, and the other on admissions. Hiring and promotion of minorities at universities generally, and decided to study instead how affirmative action had hurt Americans of Eastern and Southern European descent. While the commission is feeling so energetic, it might want to review history on the different means of transport used by blacks and Europeans to get to those shores, but I'd be afraid to read the report. The commission surely has taken up, as its banner, our president, right or wrong. It turns out the old 6-member commission the president tried to undo has been undone in the new 8-member body whose appointees are divided equally between the president and the Congress. Uneasy as I was with the president's effort to replace some members of the old commission, the authority was his to exercise as long as the commission was under the executive branch. But some finagling and not a little arm twisting of congressional leaders, I'm sure, has resulted in a commission under the legislative branch that still seems bent on following Reagan down the Yellow Book Road. That road leads to the days of old when, as only the president could have put it, America didn't have a race problem. No one yet has been able to convince the president that America didn't have a race problem when he was a boy, because blacks were invisible people, if they were recognized at all. This commission could be a clever plot by the Democrats to foil the president's reelection, but that will be giving the Democrats too much credit. No, the president can take all the credit for this. The minorities and women can return the favor by taking their votes elsewhere. On the central question of quotas, they can be made to work and turn to good so long as they are reasonable and flexible. But many think any special effort to aid minorities is unreasonable, and they don't want to be flexible on taking in even one token. Thus, the fashionable cries of reversal discrimination. Yet those who support quotas must be reasonable and flexible too. The demand may be for 10 black or female positions, but even 3 or 5 or 7 would beat the old zero. Quotas can be set in certain cases with certain deadlines and with an understanding that, once attained, maintenance will be based on performance. Minorities and women deserve special help in many cases, but they should not be excused from accountability for their performance. In the meantime, their chances for success should be helped through education, with the goal of ending quotas one fine day when that American sense of fair play really is fair. Some should tell the president and the Civil Rights Commission that that day is not yet in sight.
February 8, 1984. How Blacks Can Influence Media. The black community and the media have discovered each other in the past year, but it has hardly been pleased to meet you exchange. Around this time last year, when things were gearing up and growing ugly, before the mayoral primary, there was a rude and sudden awakening by the black community to the caliber of reportage and to the color of those presenting it. There was indeed a hypersensitivity all around, among blacks and whites, to every word written or broadcast, every photo angle, every facial expression of a television commentator. The media, long accustomed to being lambasted by the public for being the bearer of bad news, was stung as ever before. That, however, is the nature of this profession. It is not a job in which one expects to be liked. But the black community, understandably and deservedly, heady in this last year, remains at boiling. Every unkind word about the mayor, anyone on his side, or anyone black, period, is cause for protest. The reactions are too often automatic and emotional, without considering that unfavorable reporting can be valid and appropriate, or that opinions such as these presented here are one person's only. It is incumbent upon the black community to learn this and learn to disagree with such comments without being disagreeable. Over the weekend on a black radio talk show, the idea of boycotting the downtown media came up again, as it has too often. Attorney Thomas Todd, who is heading Operation Push while Jesse Jackson seeks the presidency, explained to a caller that action against the media is warranted, but that opposition to the boycott is coming from those black vendors who brave walk-ups and the weather to deliver and sell the newspapers. Let me add my voice to that of the vendors, and for the self-same and candidly self-serving reason, my livelihood. There is a course of action for the black community other than a boycott. Rather than removing itself from the media after a year of heightened and productive involvement with them, the black community should do just the opposite. It should immerse itself in the media. Those of us who are black inside the media are quoted all the time as saying our employers are not pristine in racial matters. in coverage, or in hiring and promotions. There are biases to be overcome within the institution and among individuals. There is a need for more minorities and women in positions determining what will be covered and how it will be presented. Yet it is the ideal of balance I hold as a professional that allows me as a Black to speak my mind in this space. And I defend that balance even as I see futile efforts sometimes are to attain it. If the Black community wants to do something about the media, here are some suggestions. For a start, it should study them, buy them, read them, watch them, contact them, know them, use them to advantage. It should congratulate as well as denounce the white racist media, as we, yes we, have come to be called these days all in one breath. If you feel the media don't know your community, consider that the conspiracy is born more of unfamiliarity than contempt, and help the unenlightened white reporters. When was the last time you submitted a good or bad letter to the editor, opinion piece, or idea for a feature story on a Black subject, or took up your cause with an editorial board, or sought to rebut a broadcast commentary? If in such instances you were rebuked, did you consider first the reason may have been a staffing or deadline problem, or that the idea or the writing were unacceptable or untimely, before concluding that maybe, just maybe, it was racism? And if you really want to do something about the media, encourage creative young Black writers to start freelancing now, and contribute to scholarship funds to send them to college and out into the world, and to get those reinforcements in here in a hurry, because my fingers won't hold out on these keys forever. Now that the Black community and the media have discovered each other, it's time they discovered what each other is about.
February 12, 1984. An ugly sign then, a talisman now. In my living room hangs a sign, Colored Waiting Room, NC and STL. It is an authentic glass sign from the 1920s from an authentic colored waiting room of the defunct Nashville, Chattanooga, and St. Louis Railway. It hangs strategically above the fireplace so that it is the last sight upon leaving the house and the first sight upon returning. How many other Black eyes beheld it, accepted its directive, and then averted their eyes from it, perhaps wishing it away or heading somewhere they hoped never to see the likes of it again? The sign was a rare find at an antique store. The dealer so understood my yearning to have it that he broke a promise to someone else, someone white, so that I could have it. But not everyone understands that yearning. Why, many may wonder, and not always aloud, would anyone want such a thing around? A few have taken offense at it, but what it symbolizes is so inordinarily offensive that any monetary modern-day discomfort seems trivial. A few laugh, but it's not there for laughs. What it symbolizes is sacred and solemn. It is as precious as a collection of Ming Dynasty vases. It is, in its way, a religious symbol, a talisman. It is sustenance and strength. And during February, Black History Month, I would like to use it to explain the beauty and ugliness of being Black in America and why this month is not for Blacks only. It was only 20 years ago that such signs slowly began to come down over water fountains, doorways, bus seats, train coaches, and entrances to hospitals and stores. It will be many years more before some people remove them from their minds, for there are psychological barriers of paranoia and superiority far uglier than any words on a sign. These jobs are for Blacks only. This real estate for whites only. Only this much of the economic pie should be for Blacks. There are many Blacks who want to put the thought of the sign behind them. The depth of their hurt is understandable. But history is undeniable, and the good and the bad of it must be acknowledged. A local media analyst, Brenda Verner, makes this point in her presentation on images of blacks throughout history. She has some 4,000 articles of memorabilia, books, photos, cards, and advertisement in her private collection, dating from 1760. They depict the most callous dehumanization of people, woolly-headed caricatures, bare-bottomed pickaninnies, and rotund mammies. Her slideshow presentation elicits distress gasps, and she brings the awful stereotypes up to date with criticism of television shows. What she holds up is not pretty by any means, but as blacks must face it, learn from it, so should whites. It is because of the stereotypes, the centuries of degradation, that Black History Month is celebrated. It is something that whites should feel free to share. Nothing can reverse history, but Black History Month at least tries to correct the imbalance. The celebration was begun by Black historian Dr. Carter G. Woodson in 1926 as Negro History Week, during the week of the birthdays of President Abraham Lincoln and Frederick Douglass, the freed slave and abolitionist newspaper publisher, February 12th and 14th, respectively. As it has grown into a month-long tradition, however, so has opposition to it from those who wonder why there is not a month of homage to their culture. The answer is that other cultures' contributions are acknowledged. Their history was not misplaced. Their goal, when they came to America, was to melt into the pot, and they did so by choice. Blacks did not come here by choice, had no choice as to blending in, or still lack complete choice over their destinies. And their contributions, made under duress and without compensation, have yet to be adequately chronicled and appreciated. Black children were taught others' history when they knew not their own. In truth, even Black History Month, there is not enough immersion in Black culture by other ethnic groups. And sadly, it is the only time many Black youngsters are in touch with it. But every day of every month, that sign in my living room reminds me whence I came, from a history fertile and exuberant despite adversity, about which I continue to learn and am not ashamed. My people could be sitting still in colored waiting rooms, and so that sign reminds, could I. But more important, it reminds that, with a sense of self, we never will again. February 19th, 1984. Marcus Garvey deserves a pardon. There would be no better time than during Black History Month to grant a pardon to Marcus Mosiah Garvey. The Jamaican-born Garvey became one of America's earliest advocates of Black self-help and self-pride during that period of Black literary blossoming in the 1920s, called the Harlem Renaissance. His movement, though unsuccessful, helped to germinate the philosophy that Black is beautiful. Garvey's campaign borrowed from the Russian Revolution, the embryonic movement for a Jewish state and Irish independence. Africa for Africans was his call for the continent's freedom from colonial rule. His oratory attracted thousands of blacks to his Universal Negro Improvement Association, and he had these multitudes signed up and ready to board his Black Star Line ship to return to their motherland. Although his idea was not original, freed slaves had founded Liberia in 1822. He perhaps came closest to making it seem workable on a large scale. It is ironic that bigots said offhandedly that blacks should return to Africa when Garvey's efforts to do just that were thwarted as a national security risk. Garvey's solicitations, which reportedly reached $10 million, were the basis for federal mail fraud charges against him and led to his deportation to Jamaica in 1927. He resettled in London in 1935 and died there at 52 in 1940. Now, some 60 years after his ill-fated adventure, the Jamaican government has requested that the U.S. government grant a pardon to Garvey. Prime Minister Edward Seaga asked this gesture of Vice President George Bush when Bush visited the island last October. Seaga said, "If the President of the United States found it possible to grant a full pardon to Marcus Garvey, wiping the slate clean and clear for posterity, it would enhance the consciousness, pride, and dignity of Black people throughout the world." And a new book reveals the campaign to depose Garvey, a campaign of surveillance and infiltration led by none other than a young J. Edgar Hoover. History does indeed repeat itself, since Hoover conducted a similar campaign against Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. in the 1960s. The first two volumes of a planned 10-volume set, the Marcus Garvey and Universal Negro Improvement Association papers, have just been completed by Robert A. Hill, a professor of history at the University of California, Los Angeles, who has been active in the pardon campaign. The volumes make for an unusual, if sephoric, biography that is told chronologically in an avalanche of papers. Hill culled more than 30,000 documents worldwide, including newspaper stories and Garvey's and others' articles and letters and news stories. One includes an invitation to Theodore Roosevelt to attend the Garvey Organization's musicale. But most fascinating, through the use of the Freedom of Information Act, Hill has uncovered documents proving the conspiracy against Garvey by Hoover. One Hoover memorandum reads, "He, Garvey, is an exceptionally fine orator, creating much excitement among the Negroes through his steamship proposition. In his paper, The Negro World, the Soviet-Russian Rule is upheld and there is open advocation of bullishism." An aging Hoover used this preoccupation with communist influences as justification for spying on King, too. Yet Garvey was not opposed only by those of like mind to Hoover. Many prominent Blacks of the day opposed him philosophically, including W.E.B. Du Bois, perhaps the greatest Black mind of this century. Letters from Du Bois in the volume denounce Garvey as a charlatan and advise against investing in the Black Star Line. And in Chicago, Garvey and Robert Abbott, founder of the Chicago Defender, were forever feuding, countersuing each other for libel. In its weekly comment, the Defender advised on September 6, 1919, "Such meetings as that of Marcus Garvey are more harmful than helpful to the race. Our race, it is true, is struggling hard here for justice, but the fiery little man who wants to start a Black Star Line to Africa will find conditions almost as bad in his own country, where he might better center his activities." Still, Garvey's promising vision easily preserves his place in American and Jamaican history. Now, through a posthumous and harmless pardon, it deserves respect. February 29, 1984. Jesse Jackson and the Jews. So Jesse Jackson actually did call Jews Haimies. Now, will everyone who ever called a Black a Jew or a member of any other ethnic group something despicable, please stand up. I do not mean to lessen the blow of what will go down in campaign history as Jesse's Jewish incident, but I certainly mean to point out that there is less to it than many insist. My reaction upon first hearing the reports of the slur was disbelief. Not that I didn't think Jackson capable of anti-Semitic remarks, but that the remark itself was such an un-black usage. I have heard plenty of black people insult Jews and others, but never with the word Haimi. It just sounds like such a white insult. But Jackson had an explanation for that too, saying it was used in his native South Carolina. I guess it's an Eastern, not a Chicago usage, because even a Jewish friend found it obscure in his own informal poll. But be that as it may, Jackson has repented, and better a week after the fact than not at all. Like any politician, he had to delay and choose the right moment, and Jackson did it as only he could, with chutzpah from the podium of a synagogue. And he has again managed to get more news coverage than the other candidates combined, with the help of media that are both enticed by his peacock and the great copy he makes and bent on finding ways to pluck his feathers. But the manner in which he apologized does not take away from the regrettable insult, nor does his reprimand of the Black Washington Post reporter who revealed the slur, supposedly spoken in private conversation. Jackson has been a public figure for long enough to know that anything he utters can end up on page one, no matter the color or the rapport with a journalist. And the slur is not justified because of what Jackson called an organized attempt to discredit, disrupt, and destroy my campaign by the Jewish community. A late January incident that built up just before the New Hampshire primary is suspect, but surely the Reverend knows about turning the other cheek. The Jewish community's complaint has been about his coziness with the Arabs. It is a substantial and fair issue on which to attack him, and they have, often stopping short of their own slurs. Jackson is right in that this one remark does not make him anti-Semitic, just as an unkind word about blacks in general can be spoken by someone who claims, "Some of my best friends are." Despite the uncharitable remarks on both sides, the recent disagreements over quotas, the old Jewish-Black alliance is not dead. Certainly, Jackson should not have used the term, even if innocent and unintended. Yet if every politician owned up to every racial or ethnic slur he had ever uttered, voters would have a truer picture of his personality and probably would have a lot more to vote on than a smile, party loyalty, or a position on some critical issue that they should care about but don't. What makes Jackson's case so peculiar and so uncomfortable is that blacks have been on the receiving end of so many insults for so long, and Jackson has been fighting that very thing he now stands convicted of. Such fallibility has been the undoing of politicians before. This alone will not undo Jackson. James Watt's list of sins was already long before his exit following a similar incident. But underlying all this attention is a campaign to make Jackson the black candidate and nothing more. I am one of those who has been hesitant about his candidacy, looking for a selfish motivation where perhaps there is none. But whatever doubts I may harbor, I have been appalled at the spectacle of my fellows in the media making Jackson the black candidate for blacks only. Black he is, but he has reached out to other constituencies, taking risks that his fellow presidential aspirants will not, including his Arab views. His rainbow coalition is being treated as if all of the colors are black. To borrow a line from the songwriter Paul Simon, it's not that the colors aren't there, it's just the imagination that many of the media and the electorate lack. I can waffle about and look askance at Jackson, but it would not be fair to me, and is not fair of others, to dismiss his ability to attract women, Hispanics, the elderly, and everyone else to whom he has extended his invitation, to dismiss the legitimacy of his candidacy. Jackson is a great draw. If his detractors didn't want to accredit him as more than a black candidate before the Jewish incident, it's payment for full for his membership in the fishbowl.
March 7, 1984. Fisk University rises to challenge. Fisk University in Nashville, one of the nation's earliest and finest black colleges, has fallen on hard times, but it remains dignified and undaunted. Late last year, the university was in arrears on a $170,000 natural gas bill. Service was cut off, leaving students to study while swaddled in blankets in midwinter. Through the efforts of alumni, black fraternities and churches, and even rival black colleges such as Howard University in Washington, D.C., a fund drive was begun. The university and the gas company reached agreement on time payments, and service was restored, but more than $2 million in bills remains past due. So Fisk is, as always, struggling, just like most of black America. It is nothing unusual, nothing of which to despair. Indeed, the only certainty of black life is that it will always be tough. But the intent here is not to maintain a woe are we lament. Many who are not black may find it hard to believe, but blacks tire of the state of permanent tribulation and the accompanying of bewailing of it. The national effort to save Fisk University offers black America a chance to show that it can do more than bemoan its status, that it can do for itself. Not that help from friends wouldn't be appreciated. Ironically, Fisk University has a history, again, reflecting black America generally, that is noted for adversity and for stubbornness in conquering it. The school, with an enrollment of about 800, was founded in 1866 in an empty Union Army barracks in Nashville. 4 years later, it was already bankrupt. That first fundraising effort in the early 1870s is a captivating chapter from black history. A Fisk music teacher started the Fisk Jubilee Singers. The group, in addition to helping save the school, helped to make the Negro spiritual an acceptable music form. The group went on tour to sing about the plight of the school and the need for higher education for newly freed blacks. They often were denied lodging and meal accommodations or even a chance to perform. Then at a program at Oberlin College in Oberlin, Ohio, fortune turned in their favor. They were being kept backstage and appeared that, once again, they were to be ignored. They began singing off stage during a lull in the regular program and so moved the audience that they soon were in demand, even performing for Queen Victoria in England. Today's crisis will take more than a song, but music is part of the effort. A special benefit concert will be held in the spring at the John F. Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts in the nation's capital. Among other efforts, some 70 black leaders were called together under Howard University's auspices and formed the National Committee for the Preservation of Fisk University. They pledged to raise $5 million this year. And the hat passing in the black community included one Sunday's church collections in February for Black History Month, especially significant given Fisk's role in that history. The role of black colleges has been to ensure a flow of black leaders whose considerable talents are not appreciated by other institutions. They were born to be separate and remain so, even though they have white enrollment. In a turnabout in recent years, many have had their autonomy threatened. Why do black colleges fight so hard to maintain that separatism when blacks have indicted separatism, whether it has been unequal or equal? The answer can be found in an institution such as Fisk, in the laurels it has won and in the pride it engenders in a race once thought incapable of and barred from the most rudimentary academic training. It has come too far to fail now. April 1, 1984. There are no white people. There are no white people. This bit of profundity is put forth by no less a thinker and agitator than author James Baldwin. The black writer is best known for efforts in the 1960s to censor his book, Another Country, which dealt with homosexuality and interracial love affairs. In the April issue of Essence, a magazine for black women, he once again aims his pen at the core of racism in America. His latest book, Evidence of Things Not Seen, about the murders of 29 children in Atlanta, is forthcoming later this year. In the magazine article on being white and other lies, Baldwin is, as always, explosive, defiant. He lets loose with his theory of whiteness, that it is a fraud. Ethnics who arrive on these shores perpetuated against themselves out of the necessity to deny the humanity of blacks, and that have built upon and fortified this lie until it has become their most abiding truth. And blacks were branded as such and had no say in choosing their identity. He says no one was white before they came here, where in fact, proud to be hyphenated Americans with strong ties to their mother country. But then their fear of people of color led them to fade into a generic whiteness to better ensure and exert their collective power. But Baldwin speaks quite ably for himself. There is, for example, at least in principle, an Irish community here, there, anywhere, or more precisely, Belfast, Dublin, and Boston. And there is a Jewish community stretching from Jerusalem to California to New York. There are English communities. There are French communities. There are Poles in Warsaw, where they would like us to be friends, and in Chicago, where because they are white, we are enemies. No one was white before he or she came to America. It took generations and a vast amount of coercion before this became a white country. White men from Norway, for example, where they were Norwegians, became white by slaughtering the cattle, poisoning the wells, torching the houses, massacring Native Americans, raping black women. And Jews, he says, have paid the highest price. For the Jews came here from countries where they were not white, and they came here in part because they were not white. And incontestably, in the eyes of the black American, and not only in those eyes, American Jews have opted to become white. Is this theory, you may wonder, what many or most blacks believe? It is not far from the thinking of most blacks, whatever their political or philosophical bent. And while neither Baldwin nor anyone can speak for an entire race, there is continual thought among blacks as to the why of being white, why it must be maintained so stalwartly, why is it deemed better, why it so shamelessly regulates others to a lesser stature without a fair trial, and, above all, how it justifies itself morally. Baldwin's response, and he does paint a wide swath, is that it is immoral. This necessity of justifying a totally false identity and of justifying what must be called a genocidal history has placed everyone now living into the hands of the most ignorant and powerful people in the world has ever seen, and has brought humanity to the edge of oblivion because they think they are white. Because they think they are white, they do not dare confront the ravage and the lie of their history. Because they think they are white, they cannot allow themselves to be tormented by the suspicion that all men are brothers. What does Baldwin want? He wants what black people in general want, that white people look upon them as people. And like Baldwin, many blacks wonder whether the distance between races is so great now that members of one will never be able to see the members of the other with clarity, or whether anyone cares to try. As incendiary as the words seem, he does not want, nor do blacks generally want, revenge. They only want an acceptance that their condition was not of their making, that whites acknowledge and start tearing down their own psychological barriers. Despite this potency, Baldwin's essay is not a diatribe. To those who believe it is, take up his challenge and look within to see if the seed of hate has not been embedded there, unnoticed and perhaps unwanted. Maybe then there will be no white people, or black people either. May 9, 1984. Jews and blacks still shipmates. The old alliance between blacks and Jews is strained but hardly about to collapse. The split in this traditional twosome was apparent long before Jesse Jackson's Jaime incident. 2 weeks ago, 10 blacks and Jews and the New York congressional delegation issued a letter of unity. Today, on the eve of Passover, we join together in an effort to reaffirm our long-standing bond and community of interest. The Chicago Reporter, a newsletter on race relations, talked with leaders from each community in this month's issue. It concludes that the alliance cracked because blacks felt Jews had betrayed them by abandoning the civil rights movement, and because Jews felt blacks had been ungrateful for their aid, especially after the riots of the 1960s. Certainly, some blacks dislike Jews and vice versa, yet the link forged by their shared history of oppression has been so strong that many blacks make the distinction that there are Jews and there are whites. Jewish merchants stayed behind after neighborhoods changed. As the reporter cites, many blacks always thought those merchants were cheating them, but the fact remains that the merchants were there. Jews helped found the NAACP in 1909 and bankrolled the Harlem Renaissance of black art and music in the 1920s. No black social agency seems to lack Jewish members on its board. But what bounds blacks and Jews also has entangled them. The oppressed link has turned into a game of one-upmanship, with blacks saying that they have suffered more. Blacks feel their calamitous history is not accorded the same importance as the Holocaust, even though recognizing that many people don't want to hear about the Holocaust either. And blacks know that Jews have one route to acceptability that they will never have. All the name changing in the world won't change skin color. The philanthropist link also has been twisted. As the civil rights movement grew into a black power movement, Jewish supporters came to be seen as patronizing and patriarchal. Many blacks turned on the Jews, marching and praying beside them, accusing Jews of wanting to be part of the movement only so long as blacks did not control it. This was a wrenching parting, but probably a natural progression. As Jews arose from European ghettos through education, self-pride, self-help, and inspiration drawn from a cruel, cherished history, so must blacks. Adding to the tension have been differences about the use of quotas to help end discrimination, Zionism and unquestioned U.S. support of Israel, and of late, Israel's trade agreements with South Africa. Jews view quotas as a tool of discrimination because they were used in the past to limit Jewish participation. In the Jewish view, every quota is restrictive. If the numerical goal is 7 entrants, then the 8th entrant will be shut out. Blacks may come to share that view eventually, but now 7 looks better than 0. On Israel, some of the bitterness was fostered by the rise of the black Muslim movement and its identification with Islam and Middle Eastern Arabs. But for most blacks, there is no such religious consideration. They simply do not understand why a people who so wanted their own homeland are insensitive to the Palestinian longing for the same right. And the two groups' shared contempt for prejudice should dictate that Israel not trade with the perpetrators of apartheid in South Africa. But these differences are not enough to destroy one of the most well-maintained alliances in history. How will it hold together? One way was put plainly, if crassly, by Republican mayoral candidate Bernard Epton last year after blacks did not vote for him. I certainly will save a lot of money in the future on charitable causes. To be plainer still, black groups still need the support, monetary or otherwise. Epton, who is Jewish, lost 43% of Jewish votes to Harold Washington. There is another reason the alliance will hold together. Jews, no matter how they have assimilated, recognize that they are not so far removed or safe from discrimination. They have an interest in seeing that blacks win respect. For if you scratch a person who hates blacks, you are likely to find an anti-Semite too. May 13, 1984. Opting for life in the gray area. Life isn't always black or white. City Councilman Mark Stebbins of Stockton, California, retained his seat in a special election Tuesday that had less to do with his qualifications than his true identity. Stebbins, curly-haired, blue-eyed, and white-skinned, claims to be black. The man who lost to Stebbins originally, Ralph Lee White, who was undoubtedly black, claims that Stebbins is a white man with an identity crisis. White pushed for the recall in the predominantly black district, saying that the constituents had been hoodwinked and were not being represented because, contrary to Stebbins' claim, he was not, like White, black. White, who represented the area for 12 years, offered Stebbins' birth certificate as proof. Stebbins, 41, comes from a family of six children whose other members all look and identify themselves as white. His parents, who live in Washington State, say they think of their son as white, but his outlook is black. His wife can obviously be categorized as black, but he has two former wives, one black, the other white, with two white children. But Stebbins has his disclaimer. In America, if you have a drop of black blood in you, then you are black. That's where I have established myself. As a child, I didn't have a racial identification, but I had feelings of being different at 14 when we moved to a more racially mixed area and I began to get nigger hair comments from white kids. Stebbins is just one case in the renewed debate over that gray area which defines a person's race. A Louisiana woman who had lived as a white discovered when she went for a passport that her birth certificate labeled her as black. She lost a court fight to be white based on a state law that anyone 1/32nd black was black. The court ruled against her 29/32nd whiteness. When Vanessa Williams became the first black woman to be crowned Miss America, black tongues clucked about just how black anyone that white-looking could be. They called her election a fraud and an affront because she was as close to white as black could get. This debate will never be settled, but labels can be as helpful as they are harmful. Most people find it disconcerting when they can't slot someone white or black, liberal or conservative, Democrat or Republican, middle class or upper class, etc. How nice if the racial label could be chosen. Maybe Councilman Stebbins has something here. From all indications, Stebbins is what 99% of most anyone who was asked would call white. If it behooves Stebbins to be black to get elected in a black district, if he wants to try reverse passing, more power to him. Light-skinned, straight-haired blacks have passed for white for centuries. There aren't nearly as many of the opposite case. So maybe it's a sign of progress that we now have some equal opportunity passing. Let's open membership now to anyone of any race who has ever wondered what it's like to be, what it's like on the opposite side. It might be just a way to foster understanding. It could be the first step to reaching that idealistic and elusive colorless society. All those white people who have preconceived ideas about the people in Robert Tyler homes could move in, become unemployed, and file for welfare. Since they think that blacks have this cushy life on their tax money anyway, they could try to get some of it back. If all those white ethnics who are plotting to protect the sanctity of their neighborhoods were to become black, they could find an honorable pursuit in trying to keep each other from living next door. All those black folks who think it's easy being a corporate executive could get first-hand experience at those long hauls back and forth from the suburbs. They also could suffer anxieties over their kids having the latest computers, braces, designer togs, and acceptance at the right Ivy League school. Just sign here, put it in black and white, and be the race of your choice. Oh, forget about the fine print. It just says that if you decide you don't like being the opposite of what you were, you can't go back. A mere technicality. Any takers? The line forms behind Mr. Stebbins.
May 16, 1984. School decision 30 years later. Brown versus Board of Education, the U.S. Supreme Court decision that declared an end to racially separated education, marks his 30th anniversary Thursday. Yet the mission of Brown is hardly begun. As efforts were made to live up to the decision, its intent became obscured. The means sidetracked the Brown decision from attaining its end. There was a furor over busing, angering black and white parents, and subsequent court orders that had judges ruling on everything from desegregation plans to allocation of sports equipment. The demoralization and deterioration within education generally also deflected the focus from integration. Ill-spent time and white flight worked against Brown. Most big city school systems lost too many white pupils before Brown's hypothesis could be tested. There has been an increase in private schools nationwide to circumvent the order. And many black parents now believe Brown is unworkable. Instead, they're demanding quality in an all-black setting and dismissing that their children need to rub white elbows. Chicago's own desegregation battle took 20 years. It began with a suit by parents in 1961 when the schools were still 50% white. With that ratio, desegregation may have been achieved, and so might neighborhood stabilization. But it was 2 years later before the Chicago Board of Education agreed to appoint a group of experts to develop a plan. In 1977, a citizens committee joined in the effort, but in 1979, the U.S. Department of Health, Education, and Welfare rejected the plan and referred the case to the Justice Department. In 1980, the board and the Justice Department signed a consent decree in which both sides agreed to desegregation guidelines. U.S. District Court Judge Milton Schotter accepted it just last year and continues to pass judgment on every student transfer, every cent. But beginning math proves what a farce much of the agreement is. 16% white students just won't go into 62% black and 22% Hispanic by anyone's figuring. So the Chicago system touts that it is desegregated, but only 29% or 112,000 of 435,000 students system-wide are in such schools, and those schools are defined as having between 30 and 70% white enrollment. And there remain 379 schools where there is no pretense at integration. They are euphemistically called racially isolated, which means that there is no way, no how, given the geography, that they can get anyone white into them. What they are is still separate, and all too often still unequal despite special programs. So in this city alone, much of what the Brown decision tried to stymie is actually thriving. That does not mean Brown is worthless. There are schools in which sitting next to a child of a different race is commonplace, and there isn't the remotest notion among the youngsters of how unusual such a scene appears to their parents. Where Brown falters, the whole society is to blame. There will never be mutual respect or understanding until people share all aspects of their lives, housing, work, education, recreation, and even then there will be prejudice. Brown's objectives are still worthy, perhaps because they have been so difficult to institute. That is all the more reason to continue trying. The decision may reach its centenary and receive the same evaluation. Brown stands as a monument to good intentions and to the fallacy that the force of law can really change human nature. But Brown stands nonetheless, and stately. If the changes demanded by Brown never materialize, the decision will have done its work by just putting on record America's disdain for and regret about what had gone before. The idea of a just, tolerant, and equitable society may be fanciful, but there is good in the expression of such an objective. Intent requires a different judgment than methodology. And what Brown said was that something was frightfully wrong in this country. On that, its vision was keen. It could not have been expected to see into people's consciousness.
Context of white supremacy. Again, happy birthday, Dr. Welsing. Folks are interested in commenting. The number to dial, 641-715-3640. The code is 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. Number again, 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. For folks who would like to chime in, but you don't want to use your phone, you can use the free VOPE line. It is linked at the Black Talk Radio Network. If you need the address, it is tiny.cc/1race. And that is the number 1. Address again, tiny.cc/1race. And that is the number 1. When you put that address in, click the link on the left side of the page. It should say free VOPE line. When you click it, it will open a small window on your screen. The top line, it is a drop-down menu. Select the number that I just gave out, which again is 641-715-3640. Next line, it will ask for the code. That code again, 564-943. The final line, it asks for a name. You can put in a real name, you can put in a nickname, you can press random keys, whatever you are comfortable with. Once you get all that entered, click the green button at the bottom. It should connect you to the program. You should be able to hear us live. It is the same procedure. If you would like to participate, you'll see the dial pad on your screen. Press star 6. When you do that, you should hear the audio prompt. Press the number 1, and we will get you on the line. Looking forward to hearing commentary from folks. New narrator. We had so many female volunteers who said they would be down to help out with the reading content that we will have, I think, a new narrator even for next week. So we'll have an array of different Cows listeners, black females, pitching in to do the lifting with regards to the reading for Leonina McLean's work. With that, all the folks who dialed in with a hand up should be with us. Let's see. I think Thomas in New York. Roz, retired firefighter. I will catch other folks as we ride. If we have our narrator for this week or our caller in Michigan, narrator for the last 2 weeks, if you all are there, be good to hear from you all as well, or any of the other black female listeners who might be tuning in. Callers who have a hand up, feel free to chime in.
Have you heard?
Yes, sir.
I just wanted to make a quick reference. I used to work at a job, and there was a white girl there, and there was a white guy who I worked very close with, and he used to press on her skin, and it would turn red. He would call her a hyene. And I asked him one day, I said, "What's a hyene?" He said, "Oh, that's like a old English word, you know, it resembles a hymen. And it means someone turns really red when you touch them, or that, you know, their blood is really flushed to their skin and they turn red easy. We call them a hyene." So when she brought up the reference and he was referencing the Jews as that, I was kind of stuck because that wouldn't be a color I would associate them with. But even though they are white, but usually I would associate that with like Irish or English, you know, very pale people. But I'll meet my line right now. Thank you.
For sure, Thomas in New York. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, feel free.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings to you, Gus. Thomas in New York, firefighter in Florida, all the other callers and listeners. First, I want to wish Dr. Wilson a happy birthday. Also, I wanted to give a shout out to the woman reading the book. I actually work with her, and she's doing an awesome job, so I just wanted to compliment her if she's listening tonight. This was very, it was so much, so many notes I made, so I'll try and keep it as brief as possible. The section she wrote on Dr. King, I just found that very interesting because it just, to me, it just spoke to the fact that racism, white supremacy will always sacrifice any strong black male that stands up to the system, and they will make them an example, basically, to all other black males who attempt to do the same thing. And it just seems like this was a highly sophisticated way of basically lynching him, the way that J. Edgar Hoover wanted to disparage him in his after he passed away, in order to destroy his legacy. And I just say big ups to his wife and his family for fighting to seal those records and keep that from becoming a reality. The section she wrote on page 65, there's a 55, excuse me, there's a brief paragraph that says quotas can be set in certain cases with certain deadlines and with an understanding that once attained, maintenance will be based on performance. Minorities and women deserve special help in many cases, but they should not be excused from accountability for their performance. In the meantime, their chances for success should be helped through education with the goal of ending quotas one fine day when that American sense of fair play really is fair. And that last sentence just really rubbed me the wrong way sorry to use a metaphor, just the use of the term fair. It's like nails on a chalkboard. But it really speaks to the fact that somewhere in all of her brilliance, she still believed in the lie that is America. And it just really goes to show just how, even how we're conditioned in school, having to stand up and read the national anthem every day. All of these things serve to reinforce our belief in the falsity that is America. Like when Dr. Welsing, God bless her so much, when she speaks about the fact that we are taught that we're in a system of democracy when the system is actually racism, white supremacy. I immediately thought of that when I read that section, especially when she used the term fair. Also, on the following page, she wrote something that I found very telling. She said, but in the black community, understandably and deservedly, heady this last year, remaining at boiling, every unkind word about the mayor, anyone on his side or anyone black, period, is cause for protest. The reactions are too often automatic and emotional without considering that unfavorable reporting can be valid and appropriate, or that opinions such as these presented here are one person's only. It is incumbent upon the black community to learn this and to learn to disagree with such comments without being disagreeable. This just sounds exactly what we experienced for the last 8 years with President Obama, just in this sheer abuse he got, being depicted as a monkey getting shot in the, I believe it was the New York Post, and all the other horrible things that were done to him and his family. And when she said something, the last sentence where she said, it is incumbent upon the black community to learn this and to learn to disagree with such comments without being disagreeable. Black people are not allowed to be disagreeable. We get shot. If we say anything, they're ready to, you know, punch us in the face like the brother at the Trump rally, or shoot you, pretty much. So I just found that to be a case of anti-blackness, simply because we're not allowed to be disagreeable. You might have, you know, situations, individual situations, where a black person might be quote-unquote disagreeable, whatever that really means, and get to walk away from it without being destroyed or mutilated. But for the most part, we're not allowed to do that. And there was a section where she wrote at the bottom of the page, if you feel the media don't know your community, consider that the conspiracy, in quotes, is born out of unfamiliarity and contempt, and help the unenlightened white reporters. When was the last time you submitted a good or bad letter to the editor, opinion piece, or to the editor, opinion piece, or idea for a feature story on a black subject, or took up your cause with an editorial board, or sought to rebuke a broadcast commentary? And if in such instances you were rebuked, did you consider first that the reason might have been a staffing or deadline problem, or that the idea or the writing were unacceptable or untimely, before concluding that maybe, just maybe, it was racism? That just seems to be a bit of her confusion again, simply because she's making excuses for things that happen on a regular basis and have happened since the founding of this country, as far as the media being used to destroy white people. Just take Black Wall Street, for example, the perpetuation of the sexual mistreatment of a white female on an elevator, causing the complete destruction of a black town that was doing very well, even though being completely surrounded by Klan towns. So to me, she just doesn't see things very, very clear in that sentence, and it's, in a way, it's another form I see of anti-blackness, in my opinion. When she wrote about the sign that she got, the sign that she got in the other section, the following essay, I agree to something that you said on the show many times about not taking down these signs that are vestiges of overt white supremacy. I agree with her on that, and I found that to be a level of black self-respect, simply because the way things are now, where everything is hidden in plain sight, and the way that racism is practiced in such a subtle but very powerful way, I think those signs are awesome reminders of what the system really is, and as a result, they should not be taken down until the system of white supremacy is replaced with justice. I found the section on Marcus Garvey very, very to be extremely important, simply because J. Edgar Hoover never actually hired, if he refused to hire any black FBI agents, and he hired his first FBI agent, black FBI agent, in order to infiltrate Garvey's movement, and Garvey ended up promoting him, I believe, to like either the second or third person, as far as he was at the top, and there was two other people next to him, and one of those two, I forget his name, I believe it starts with an R, but he was the actual federal agent who set him up to get caught up on the postal fraud charges that the United States government utilized to get him deported from this country. And I just, the entire history of Marcus Garvey and W.E.B. Du Bois and Robert Abbott was just, to me, it was extremely sad simply because of the extreme levels of anti-blackness that were put out on public display and the rift that it caused, because Garvey was highly upset not only with just Du Bois' ideologies, but he also didn't like him because he was light-skinned. And Dr. Ben used to talk about that too, about Marcus Garvey having issues with light-skinned black people in certain ways, in certain situations it would come out in his speaking. And I just found it to be very sad, because if we could have gotten things together, maybe things might have been a little bit different. I'm going to stop there because there's just so much I wanted to talk about, but I don't want to take up too much time and allow other people to speak. So I'll just mute my line, and maybe if I get the chance, I can chime in a little bit later. Thank you.
For sure. Other folks who dialed in, we haven't heard from retired firefighter. If you had commentary, any other folks who are listening who have comments, retired firefighter, you should be with us, sir.
Yes, sir. Greetings to everyone. First and foremost, I would like to thank the ladies. I recognize some of the voices that are doing the reading. I have been a part of a lot of different efforts based on black people attempting to destroy the system of racism, white supremacy, and replace it with a system of justice. And the ladies have always have involved themselves wholeheartedly and did a large amount of work in those efforts. So I just like to thank the ladies that I'm hearing that are doing the reading. Very interesting from what I'm hearing. I have a brief question. This is someone's diary, correct?
She was a journalist, so these were essays that were published in the Chicago Tribune or the Washington Post.
Okay.
You know, big time columns.
Okay. Well, anyway, interesting. It sounds like the average non-white black person that I'm used to hearing on a daily basis with their comments and ideas and understandings of things in regards to the system of racism, white supremacy. And I won't speak on that directly because she's not alive to really have a conversation with. But anyway, what was interesting was her knowledge and understanding of J. Edgar Hoover in his long reign of terror on non-white people. And there was no limit to what he was willing and able to do, to where he even intimidated white people in the process, literally until the day he died. From my understanding, the first quote unquote black FBI agent was his butler, his driver, that sort of thing. I'm pretty sure he was going to get almost 100% loyalty with that person as far as what he wanted him to say and do. I was becoming nauseated when I'm hearing the term Jews and blacks. Like Mr. Fuller has said, it doesn't make any sense. The term itself, Jews and blacks, it doesn't make any sense at all. What I expect where it came from was very refined white people. I could be wrong, but I suspect that term came from very refined white people. Once the conversation goes on beyond the title, Jews and blacks, it sounds very much like white people and their behavior, their attitudes on things. Yes, they basically paid for a lot of things that were so-called to be organizations and or efforts for black people to dismantle the system of racist white supremacy. And as we know, we're still under that condition. So it just goes to show you on how refined these white people are, who are disguising themselves under what I know is a religion that's called Judaism. But it's interesting on what she had to report on that subject matter. And it still holds true today as far as that concerned. The quote-unquote Jaime incident, I recall that it was when I was younger. I was not a retired firefighter then when Mr. Jackson was a candidate for president, and he ran into that particular problem. But anyway, those are the things that I was thinking about, especially that blacks and Jews statement that is still, unfortunately, is popular. That's why I try to stick with white, non-white, white supremacists. And I don't get confused. Thank you.
For sure. Person dialed in from a blocked number. If you had commentary, you should be with us.
Yes. Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Are you getting static? Can you get static on my end?
Well, now it sounds like you're breaking up a little bit. I could hear you first, but it sounds like your line, there's some distortion or it's breaking up somehow.
Okay, this sounds clearer now.
Give us another sentence. Let's see.
Does it sound clearer?
A little bit. I can make you out now, so it's improved a little bit.
Okay. I just wanted to say that it sounded like she was giving the so-called Jews accolades when she was saying that they started the Harlem Renaissance. But the only reason they started the Harlem Renaissance is because black people were starting to make great strides in science and math, and the so-called Jews wanted to shut that down. And I just think that man that black man that snitched on Jesse Jackson was terribly wrong. The one that snitched on him with the Heine comment. I don't think black people should snitch on each other. I think we should stand together as much as possible. That's all I want to say.
Right on. We should have time if other folks have comments that they want to make sure they get in before we get to the second audio segment. Sorry, we should have time to do so. Just some of the quick things that stood out that I wanted to make sure I got in. Number one, just to recognize, like, she had a pretty, Ms. McClain, she had a pretty wide spectrum of topics that she covered, which I think, you know, that deserves some commendation to be writing about what happened with Dr. King and being harassed by FBI, COINTELPRO, J. Edgar Hoover, the HBCUs with Fisk University, the election with Harold Washington, James Baldwin and his writing. She seemed to cover quite a bit of quite an array of topics, which is, I think, impressive for a writer. And most of these, it seems like they're coming out on about a weekly basis. So she was active and trying to cover as much as she could. Some of the things that stood out, the first piece on the Civil Rights Commission looks back When I heard that piece, the name Clarence Pendleton came to mind, like, immediately. People that have been listening to the program for a while, I remember, I think it was 2013 when I first learned about Clarence Pendleton, who he is, why he's significant. I know I've mentioned his name quite a few times on the program, but he was on, not just on, the Civil Rights Commission. This, I think, was an appointment by Ronald Reagan. He was president at the time, but he was the chairman of the Civil Rights Commission, Clarence Pendleton, this black male. And the reason that I remember him and I mention his name so consistently, ghostwriting. We had a white male suspected racist on the program, Colin Flaherty, 2013, where he said that he used to write speeches secretly, and then they would put them out and just lie and say that Clarence Pendleton wrote them. And it would be things, he would write things, because he's a white person, suspected race soldier, he would write things that were in support of white supremacy, but this black male, Clarence Pendleton, who's on the Civil Rights Commission, he would take all the blame. So black people would get all upset and be calling him an Uncle Tom and blah, blah, blah. They, in fact, when they talked about him, he's dead now, but when they talked about him, they said that he used to be, when people thought about an Uncle Tom named Clarence, they would think Clarence Pendleton in the 80s, not Clarence Thomas. That's the opinion that people had of him at the time. And then you find out after he's dead, from a heart attack, no less, that this white guy was writing a lot of the things that he was being criticized for and bashed for. Again, the problem is white people. They are most to blame. But just as I continued with that report where they're talking about affirmative action and quotas and all of this is a really inept and sloppy means of response to white terrorism. That is at the forefront. It's not black people asking for handouts or people trying to get something, to get a job that they're not qualified for. All of this is in response to white people practicing racism, which should be at the forefront of everything. In addition to any time we're going to talk about affirmative action, everyone should be broadcasting loud, and I mean as boldly as possible, any conversation of affirmative action should begin with white women, not black people and unqualified Negroes got into this school or got this job, but they didn't deserve it. And, you know, oh, what a travesty this is that, you know, some qualified applicants. But no, if anything, it is white women. And it never happens that way. It's always to put black people on the defensive as though they got something that they didn't earn, didn't deserve, which is just another form of racism in practice. Some of the other things that stood out there, the term minorities and women, I'm of the opinion that term should never be used. It's confusing. To me, it almost sounds as though minorities are all males. Number one, minorities, that shouldn't be used at all. If they're talking about non-white people, clearly you have non-white males and non-white females who are victims of racism. When they're saying this, I almost think that it should be, you're saying non-white people and white women, because that's the way that it ends up sounding to me when they talk about this, as though white women are somehow also being mistreated by white males and they're not being given the same opportunities to do things. But I mean, even that, just further, when you start to make it that clear, just further exemplifies the incorrectness of the whole statement, because now you're talking about white females who should also be suspected of practicing racism, who are a part of the problem that we're trying to correct with non-white people, males and females, not getting jobs, not getting employment, applications, college, you know, et cetera. The next piece where how blacks can influence the media, I think you all touched on that. That one was kind of difficult to read. Kind of keep in mind, just looking at some of the dates as well as these articles, this is getting closer to when she committed suicide. I think all the essays that we heard this week were written in 1984, and she committed suicide Memorial Day of 1984. So that's something that I just kind of keep in mind. Particularly for this essay, How Blacks Can Influence Media, where it almost sounded like she was, I think it was Ross who was saying she's kind of apologizing for racist-dominated news outlets, media outlets, and the way that they cover non-white people, black people in particular. Even some of the comments that she makes about, you know, saying, well, before you jump to the conclusion that it's racism, maybe you should help an uninformed white person. And she kind of starts the piece off saying that the media and blacks discovered each other. Just to me, she made a lot of statements within that report that suggest, once again, that white people are ignorant about black people, that they just don't know, and that whatever they're doing, the way that they write about black people, this is not them practicing racism, that this is just white ignorance, which is extremely common, which I submit is extremely incorrect. We should also push back really hard against that as well. This is racism should never be explained away or excused as a result of just white people are inept. They just didn't know any better. Even within that piece where she says that some of the responses when I guess they would have articles or what have you talking about Harold Washington or his supporters or black people in general, that some of the responses that they just seemed automatic and emotional. That's kind of the way that I'm accustomed to racists talking about black people and just saying, oh, you all are just emotional. You're so sensitive. You just get so riled up in time. So just talking to black people like they're children. That's kind of the way that I felt in reading, hearing the piece, and I just kept in mind she is a victim. Clarence Pendleton could have been some influence in getting her to write this piece and the tone that the piece took on. I do agree, though, some of the points that she made about studying the media, because she was saying as opposed to boycotting, which I do not agree with. I certainly would encourage, hey, do not purchase, you know, if we're talking newspapers or any other forms of media, what have you. I certainly agree with that. But I agree with the point where she raised about studying the media. That's something that I try to do myself, studying the way that they write, the way that they talk about racism, white supremacy, or just any issues, words that are used. I definitely encourage that. That's something that I try to do myself. Also, the importance of encouraging black people to write themselves, independent black journalists, Black Talk Radio Network, and other outlets, fantastic, where we don't have to just sit around and complain about whites practicing racism, which we should expect them to do. We can have our own outlets to do our own writing. Ida B. Wells. The next piece where she was talking about Fisk University and their problems, this piece was written more than 30 years ago, and they're still having the same difficulties with a lot of the HBCUs. We talked about that with South Carolina State last year. And it just, again, as I was saying, it's a lot of what we touched on already, just all of this, white people are most to blame. There's a lot of evidence, and it's not just South Carolina State, that a lot of these black, quote-unquote black institutions, when they run into problems, white people are directly to blame, if not indirectly. But a lot of times it's white people are directly to blame, particularly if it's anything finances, where they have deliberately defunded them or kept them from getting adequate funding. That was the case, and they had the evidence. This is not just me making up stuff. They had all the evidence with South Carolina State, and it was widespread where they were doing this, where they were taking funds that were supposed to be allocated for these black schools and reallocating them to predominantly white institutions. That was the first thing that came to mind, the dominant thing that came to mind. She was talking about what was going down at Fisk. It just sounds very similar to what I'm hearing now, 2016, about these institutions. The piece where she wrote, "There Are No White People," where she was writing about a column that James Baldwin wrote, and I guess this was the lead up to his book, The Evidence of Things Not Seen. I have read that book, so it was a little odd for me, and I realized just in reading Miss McClain's piece that that book that Baldwin authored had not been released yet, that he wrote this essay where he was just talking about racism, and I guess it was mentioned maybe doing some publicity for this book that was about to come out. But I mean, that is a really, if you want to talk about intense example of racism, white supremacy, what was happening in Atlanta in the early 80s, I'm surprised even Ms. Kling didn't, you know, have more to say about that. But just that piece and a lot of her writing, just the, if you don't understand racism, what it is, how it works, everything else will confuse you. And it just seemed to come through glaringly in that piece, in the way that she talked about racism, in terms of us wanting acceptance. She said that, I think, and she was even quoting Baldwin in agreement, you know, that we need to just work at the races accepting each other. For one, there's only one race, that is the white race. Black people do not belong to a race, and it's not about acceptance. I think Thomas talks about that all the time, about that wanting that white acceptance, white validation, and just the incorrectness of all of that. You are setting yourself up for eternal heartbreak, eternal victimization. Put those together because you just don't have an accurate understanding of what it means to be white and the behaviors that you can expect from them on into eternity. where they have set up this way of thinking that, oh, we just need to get to know each other. We just need to be friends. We just need to work at accepting. That's not what this is about at all. And just seeing that in her writing, where she just either has a difficult time accepting that, she doesn't understand that. This piece was written not quite a year after the piece, How Chicago Taught Me to Hate Whites, where she seemed to be getting some of this, but I think we noted, you know, we talked about this last week, it seemed like it was very painful, it was very difficult for her to accept this. Like, she had some strong emotional bonds, ties to whites. She was still talking about her white friends at the end of that piece, and it came through again in this one. This denial of race, I think Dr. Welsing, she said on this program emphatically that we do a lot of that, trying to deny racism. That's not to say that you have a quote-unquote scientific white race, but we do have, unfortunately, the concept of race is real, the concept of a white race is real, and we just need to get an accurate understanding of what that means and how that governs their thoughts, speech, actions, emotions as it relates to non-white people and especially black people. Retired firefighter did a great job with his commentary on blacks and Jews. Totally incorrect. Jews are not a racial classification. And I saw a lot of the same things there, too, just looking for that white acceptance, white friends, white people that are not racist. And again, that just sets you up to talk about racism in a really incorrect manner and sets you up to be eternally disappointed, eternally victimized. I think I will pause there, see if we have any other folks. The school desegregation piece, same thing, came through there glaringly as well. This wanting us to be in school together, it'll be great if we could all just be in school together. This would just be wonderful, and we'll make so much progress. And at 216, I think they did all those reports over the last 2 years talking about schools are as segregated now as quote-unquote segregated now as they were 50 years ago, where whites have just made it plain they're not interested in having large numbers of white children sitting next to little Negroes in their classrooms. And even if they are there, that certainly does not mean that they have divested from the practice of racism, white supremacy. Just not having clarity, not having accurate information about what racism is, how it works, and or not willing to accept truth about what it means to be white, what racism is, how it works. Put those two together. Folks, have any other commentary? If we have any other callers, if you were not able to participate at all, you should dial in now before we get to the second audio. And certainly any of the other folks who dialed in who already shared, if you have additional comments you want to get in, feel free.
One thing to say, this university named after a white man, so just keep that in mind as well.
As are many of the HBCUs. The caller at 9401. 9401, did you have commentary you wanted to get in?
Hello, good night. Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Yeah, I was I was listening to your commentary about white validation. And I was thinking to myself that, you know, white people control everything. They validate everything that we do. What time we go to work, when we work, where we live, everything. So I can understand somebody seeking actual, you know what I mean, white people validating them because of the system that we live in. You know what I mean? We all have to get white validation to do whatever we want to do in life. And that's my commentary. Thank you.
Right. Logical.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
I found something in the essay that she wrote about called Marcus Garvey Deserves a Pardon that I found very telling. She wrote, it was on page 59, although his idea was not original, freed slaves had founded Liberia in 1822. He perhaps came closest to making it seem workable on a large scale. It is ironic that bigots say offhandedly that blacks should return to Africa when Garvey's efforts to do so, to do just that, were thwarted as a national security risk. And I just found that to stand out glaringly, like you said earlier, in regards to the rhetorical ethics of white people, Dr. Marimba Ani. This statement just really proves that racism always comes first. The reason why black people leaving, let's say, on the Black Star Line with Garvey to go back to Africa would be a national security risk is the fact that we are the financial lifeblood of America. Our systematic abuse is what makes America what it is. And without black people, this country would collapse. So even in them saying go back to Africa to black people, they still understand that systematically the only way America could remain what it is to have black contribution through its systematic abuse under the system of racism, white supremacy. So I find that to be extremely telling. Oh, there's a section she wrote on page 64 in the Fisk University piece. She said, the role of black colleges has been to ensure a flow of black leaders whose considerable talents were not appreciated by other institutions. They were born to be separate and remain so, even though they have white enrollment. In a turnabout in recent years, many have had their autonomy threatened. Why do black colleges fight so hard to maintain their separatism when blacks have indicted separatism, whether it has been unequal or equal? The answer can be found in an institution such as Fisk, in the laurels it has won and in the pride it engenders in a race once thought incapable of and barred from the most rudimentary academic training. It has come too far to fail now. And when she said that the answer could be found in Fisk and speaks about pride, it really had nothing to do with pride. The reason we needed our own institutions was because when we were, quote unquote, integrated into white schools, white people really came up with the highest level of refined racism, white supremacy, by putting white females as, I believe on one of your shows, they said it was over 70% of teachers in this country that teach the youth, I guess, from elementary school to high school are white females. So they put white females in front of black children. We as black children tend to worship them because a female teacher would be considered a surrogate mother figure. Then from there, they're miseducating us and teaching us racism, white supremacy in the form of letting us know our place in society. So we needed our own institutions in order to have our own autonomy in what we were teaching our children to prepare them for the system that they were born into. And it just really strikes me that no one says this about yeshiva universities, which are all Jewish institutions. They have a couple of them in New York City, where I'm from. And ultimately, they don't allow anyone who is not Jewish, meaning that your mother has to be of Jewish descent, into those universities. And no one complains, no one raises any sort of fuss to be allowed in these institutions. Yet all of the HBCUs have now allowed whites in. They've even had affirmative action programs where white people have fought to get into black institutions, saying that black institutions were performing reverse racism by not allowing them in, when blacks, under the special circumstances that we are under, should have our own institutions and always should have, and they should have been supported financially by the government due to the fact that we were enslaved. But racism, white supremacy would not allow something like that. So I just found that to be an error on her part, not anything to really chide her about or anything like that. She's another victim, but it's just, I guess I would call it a misperception. There was a section she wrote about Jews and blacks in that section where she said, certainly some blacks dislike Jews and vice versa, yet the link forged by their shared history of oppression has been so strong that many blacks make the distinction that there are Jews and then there are whites. Jewish merchants stayed behind after neighborhoods changed. As the reporter cites, many blacks always thought those merchants were cheating them, but the fact remains that the merchants were there. And when she speaks about our shared history of oppression, a lot of times, even before the Holocaust, Jews tend to go back speaking about their so-called enslavement in Egypt, which never happened, and that I tend to hear quite a bit as well when the mood suits them to speak on it. And that's something that historically never happened. Dr. Ben spoke expressly of the fact that by the time the final pyramid was built in Egypt, it was 1,000 years before the first Jew, Abraham, was born. So that in and of itself just destroyed that entire theory. And then Zahi Hawass also had a special on National Geographic where he also brought out the same information. I believe this was in the late 90s, if I'm not mistaken, early 2000s. And I just find that telling because these are all the misconceptions and lies that are told to black people to get us to align ourselves with Jewish people who now have been accepted as white people and basically treat us no different than white people, just like racist white supremacists. And it's really interesting because Jews don't speak up to Harka, who actually went to save them when they were attacked by the Assyrians during his reign in Egypt. And the reason he went to do so was because at that time, Jews were black people. And now that they have mixed with Europeans, the European ones anyway, look like they do today. And, of course, they function as racist white supremacists. Thank you very much, and I'll mute my line.
For sure. I also wanted to make sure I got in as well. We have about 9 minutes before we get to the second audio clip. That piece, Opting for Life in the Gray Area, fascinating for many reasons, where she's talking about Mark Stebbins, this racist suspect who ran for an elected office, city councilman in Stockton, California, and he pulled the Rachel Dozel. For folks, I put an article up that was on Slate where they talked to him last year when the whole Rachel Dozel situation broke, because it's pretty similar. This is an individual where his parents even are in Washington State, Mr. Stebbins, which is the same for Rachel Dozel, if memory serves correctly. But where he is running for office and he's saying that I'm a black person and, you know, I feel what it's like to be a black person. And, you know, we moved to a predominantly white area and they said I had nigger hair growing up. So, you know, of course I'm going to identify with black people. And he runs and, you know, he wins this seat. And then they have a recall election where his Mr. White, ironically, and he is a non-white person, non-white male, where he says that he has duped voters. He's tricked them. He's trying to pretend that he is a black person and he's not. I thought this was fascinating because it seemed like she did say this. She says that this is great, more power to him. She says, direct quote, more power to him if this is what he did do some reverse passing to help him get office. This is great. Wouldn't it be great if we could all just, you know, select our racial classification? And then she kind of goes down the end and saying that white people could do this if they have gripes about black people getting over on their tax dollars, on welfare and what have you. And then black people, if we think it's so easy to go ahead and be a white person, I'll just read what she says. All those black folks who think it's easy being a corporate executive could get firsthand experience at those long hauls back and forth from the suburbs. They also could suffer anxieties over their kids having the latest computer, braces, designer togs, and acceptance at the right Ivy League schools. And she kind of ends it there talking about people if, you know, they think the other side, if you were to switch to a different racial classification for things to be better, it might not be as wonderful as you think it is. Did anybody have any thoughts? Did this stick out to anyone for any reason?
Absolutely. I didn't want to take up too much time talking, but that stood out in leaps and bounds in my mind, simply because she tried to literally make black people feel sorry for white people getting the benefits of racism, white supremacy. The sole reason they live in the suburbs miles away from the city where they have jobs was because they wanted to get away from black people who moved into the urban areas or inner city areas. So it's just like mass confusion. That whole section where she writes about that, I find that to be extremely telling about just how confusing the system can be for someone who has close relationships with white people, is being abused by black people because they're quote unquote successful and successful amongst white people, and also educated, and that imbalance of being abused from both sides and not understanding the overall reason for her abuse from her own people and her mistreatment from her colleagues and so-called friends.
Anybody else? Anything stand out from this this essay, Opting for Life in the Gray Area?
Well, what I took from it was a question I'm going to ask the next white guest we have that talks about white privilege. And I was going to ask them, what percentage of white people do you think would choose to be black if you had the chance to give each other the option and see what they would say? Because I think that would show that they're not ignorant. And it sounds a lot like the white privilege argument that white people come with today.
Anything else? Anybody else?
I always felt I always felt that comparing non-white people, especially non-white black people who are victims of racism, white supremacy, to white people, is always, it's not gonna end in a constructive way. You know, when you start in on that particular type of discussion, I just don't see it coming out constructive in any kind of way. And I do hear a lot of non-white black people making those kind of comparisons. White people, when white people do it, I automatically suspect them of practicing racism automatically. When they do it, but when non-white black people do it, it's like give me a headache or something, you know, when I start hearing that kind of comparison.
Yeah, agreed. I thought that was rather fascinating, to be in a system of white supremacy. And again, I've said before, we should really avoid terms that make it seem like this is the Hatfields and McCoys, that this is two equals who are just having a little spat. And once we get over this disagreement, everything will be, because that's simply not what it is. This is an astronomical power differential where whites are terrorizing deliberately, knowingly, willfully, consciously, gleefully, in most instances, terrorizing black people. And that's the way that we should describe it. And certainly we should not be comparing this to, you know, if we could switch places and see how tough it is for white folks and all the things that they have to do, maybe we wouldn't complain so much. I mean, that is, wow. I can only highlight again, this piece was written May 13th, 1984. This is literally days before she committed suicide. So, black mental health, again.
One more small thing, Gus.
Yes, sir.
Even from the standpoint of, and I hear this a lot, of non-white black people saying that we want to be equal to white people. What the hell does that mean? You know, it don't even sound good, you know, saying it. You know, it's not all that concerned, but that's a popular, thing mistakenly, I think we do.
Absolutely.
I agree with that too, because I think the only thing I want equal is justice. I don't want any other equality with them. You know, I can stay away from them. As long as if something happens and I get treated the same way by their law, then I'm fine.
We had one more person I want to make sure we got in. Other caller that dialed in, did you have comments you wanted to get in before we get to the second audio?
Yes, I just had a quick comment. You know how you were acknowledging that she was paying attention to a broad range of subjects and, you know, looking at all of them, you know, just with you know, just giving them all real due consideration. I have come across people, and at first I used to do this, but I've learned not to do this because of Cal. There is only one subject, and it is racism, white supremacy. It's not the schools. It's not violence. It's not Marcus. It's not any of that. There's just one subject, racism, white supremacy. And I think in her not appreciating that and really, really accepting that, she was overwhelmed by the many different ways that came at her instead of realizing on that in-depth level, like Dr. Welsing said, that it's just really one thing. Because if it seems like a million things, you can get overwhelmed and it can feel hopeless. But if it's one thing, no matter how big it is, it's still just one thing. That was my comment.
Well said. Well said. Well said. Before we get to the second audio, we should have time if anybody had another quick comment as well. Just on the validation thing, I think it's very logical. Great point the female caller made about this system. It almost necessitates for victims of racism that you get something validated by whites, whether it's you get your education validated so that you can get this job, whether you get your resume and your credentials and what have you validated so that, you know, you can have your career and take care of yourself, whatever it is, that is almost required by this system. However, I think that is
very different when you are acknowledging the power dynamic that is in place on this planet where whites are in charge, that they have this power over me. And so to do certain things until we have corrected this, I might have to go and get them to validate, get them to sign off on whatever this is for something that I want to do that is of constructive value. Acknowledging that as opposed to I want them to accept me and I want them to accept me as a friend. I want them to accept me as a human being. I want them to accept and see me as something other than a victim of racism. I think those are two very different things. And I think frequently, because of that power dynamic requiring us to do the former, we end up wanting the latter. And that is just not going to happen. And I think most of us can testify it's very difficult even to get the former in most cases, meaning just getting them to validate, yes, I did get this education. I did everything that you asked me to do. I went to these schools. I took these classes, did this, went on this job. I got this certification. I got this training. Even that can be a hassle, much less just getting them to accept you. I'm just a human being. Just on that basis, I should be treated correctly. I mean, that's just not going to happen. And I think for a lot of us, we have a very difficult time getting away from that, wanting, begging whites to accept us, befriend us, go to bed with us, however it ends up being manifested. That, I think, is extremely dangerous and just destined for, as I said, eternal heartache, eternal victimization. We will pause there so we have ample time after the audio clip concludes. If you had other comments you wanted to get in, just jot a note down, and we should be able to get your comments in after this clip concludes. The next section, the editor, Miss McLean's former husband, Clarence Page, black male, the book is in sections, right? So the first section is race. This section is politics, which is odd because I feel like most of this section was political, but anywho. So this section is politics, and Mr. Page has like a short one-page introduction to set up this section of the book. So first you hear Mr. Page, and then the next essay starts January 12, 1983, and so it resets. So we had been we're still moving chronologically, but since it's a new section, it resets chronologically. So we're going back to January 12, 1983, and then we'll move chronologically through the rest of this section. All right, Leonida McLean. A Foot in Each World, Context of White Supremacy, audio segment number 2.
Politics. Leonida McLean's columns presented not only the perspective of a black woman, but also the viewpoint of a lifelong urban dweller who was married spiritually to a love for all that the nation's cities have to offer. As such, she beheld nothing but disdain for the politics who would sell out the city's best long-term interests for the sake of their own short-term political gain. As a result, she tended to approach politics in much the same way that her father would wait up for his daughters during their teen years, with a Bible in one hand and a baseball bat in the other. Her political analysis was tempered with an uncompromising sense of moral rectitude, yet delivered in an often unconfrontational style, well in keeping with Chicago's tradition of feisty journalism. She concerned herself more with urban politics than any other kind and consistently searched for developments in Chicago and other cities that had national repercussions. As it turned out, her career as a columnist coincided with the stormy transition of power from Mayor Jane Byrne to Mayor Harold Washington, a political conflict that typified the way northern industrial cities have moved from mostly white mayors to mostly black mayors, and how traditionally liberal urban ethnic Democrats have been wooed and seduced by conservative Republicans who use racial fears to undermine old Democratic Party power. McLean's political sense came from her experience as part of a generation of Chicago youth who had known no other mayor but Richard J. Daley, the very prototype of the big city boss. Though many who mistakenly perceive McLean as an anti-white or subversively anti-establishment mind find it hard to believe, she often expressed an underlying respect and admiration for Mayor Daley during his life and afterward. If there was anything she admired about Daley more than anything else, she said, It was that he cared about Chicago, and that was a lot more than she could say for the movers and shakers who worked downtown every day, earning their keep from the city's resources, only to scamper to the suburbs before nightfall. It was a scenario that disturbed her deeply. She would often say that her value as a columnist was to provide a voice not just for Black people's interests, but also for those who loved big cities and wanted to help them to prosper as homes for the broadest possible variety of people and ideas. January 12, 1983. Gender's impact on elections. What with the stifled mumblings about race and ethnicity in the city's mayoral campaign, the issue of gender has become even more muffled. Yes, there are a Black and two Irish Americans running, but one of them is also a woman. Discussions of the gender gap were all the rage in the November elections, partially in Illinois with the tarnish of the failure of ERA still upon Governor James Thompson. In the upcoming election with a powerful woman incumbent, the subject of gender is curiously absent. For a woman, Mayor Jane Byrne did a remarkable job of keeping that component out of her first campaign. But for a woman who was elected with the help of female voters, she has not done very much to further the rights of women. She donned a white dress in the summer heat and marched for the ERA, but all of her closest advisors are men. She does have one high-ranking woman in her cabinet, but that woman runs the most women's issue-type department, Commissioner Lenora Cartwright in Human Services. Other of her appointments of women also have been to sex role stereotype positions. Marie Cummings of the Fine Arts Council and businesswoman Sally Berger of the Library Board. The naming of Ruth Love to run the schools was more of a function of race than gender. A case of the lucky twofer in the parlance of corporate affirmative action headhunters. To take nothing from these women, having a woman as mayor did not necessarily raise anyone's consciousness. So it was surprising when Pat Horn of the Midwest Women's Center here mentioned that Mayor Byrne had the vote of professional women sewn up. No sexism pun intended. If this is indeed the case, is it more honorable to vote gender than race? Both conditions are matter of birth. The type of well-educated, business-suited, attaché case-swinging woman Horn is alluding to is the kind you think would not follow Byrne blindly just because Byrne is a woman. Is her holding office that symbolic? Horn believes that many of these Byrne supporters, some of whom are high-powered in their own fields, are one-issue ERA forever, and feel obligated to return the favor to the mayor. If one wants to deal with women's issues, the two male candidates have credible records. Predictably, though, last November's elections prove, once again, no election is predictable. Daley's female supporters are of the pro-life and or pink-collar variety. The defection of State Senator Dawn Clark Nesh from the lakefront liberal anti to the Bridgeport home team surely has helped him. As a state senator, Daley fought long and hard and unsuccessfully to kill the sales tax on food and medicine, which is still a woman's bailiwick. A woman heads the juvenile division in the state's attorney's office, which is an area dealing with youngsters, but her charges are hardly children by anyone's definition. Daley's office also has done tremendous work on prosecuting domestic violence cases. Still, some women in the myopic ERA faction won't forgive him for not pulling more of his considerably strong strings in Springfield. If one were voting on feminist issues alone, Harold Washington's longtime liberalism and record on social programs should do him a world of good.
Among working class and poor women concerned about the feminization of poverty, Washington is the obvious choice. Apparently, black women know which ascendant of their birth carries the greater liability. No doubt, cognizant that the two men in the race are running circles around her, the mayor has just named a woman's panel to look into allegations of discrimination in city government, pay, and promotions. The complaints are based on a study of the city payroll that found that 4 of 5 male city workers are paid more than $20,000 a year, but only 1 of 5 women make as much. The panel of 7 women, headed by Dave Piercy of Women Employed, will review pay and career opportunities. The group also will establish a career development program for women seeking managerial positions, perhaps like running a city. In announcing the panel, the mayor recalled her days as the party's token female. During those years in her proper place as consumer sales commissioner aiding homemakers, she zipped from supermarket to supermarket to ferret out short sheeted rolls of toilet paper. She said men in the office were called inspectors and women female shoppers at lesser pay. Having had such first-hand experience with sex bias, it is especially peculiar that she has just come upon the idea of helping women a few weeks before the election. January 16, 1983. New sparks in forensic fire. Marquette Parks is an all-white Southwest Side neighborhood whose level of racial tolerance was indicated by its being the home of Chicago's neo-Nazi party until the organization's leader was convicted of child molestation. Pusinski Country refers to the all-white area Northwest Side where Alderman Roman Pusinski, a former United States congressman, was a leading political figure. The spectacle of organizations racing to cash in on the mayoral debates last week as the Sun-Times canceled and then reinstated its forum was as unseemly as the conduct of the candidates. The on-again, off-again debates supposedly are on again, but don't believe it until you see the post-debate media analysis. Everyone now has been dealt a piece of the action in 4 debates, including black radio station WBMX, the League of Women Voters, and the City Club, co-sponsoring with the Urban League. However, there is yet another proposal in case everything falls through again, mine. The details are still being worked out, but who cares about the details? I propose the following. Number 1. The treasure hunt and road rally debate. Clues to the debate site will be hidden around the city, much like that contest to find a case of booze. The first candidate to reach the site will be declared the winner and guaranteed up front 10,000 fraudulent votes. This way, everyone will be spared a debate, which no one seems to want anyway. This also will make for the best media event. Number 2, the sing-along debate. Again, no one will have to talk issues. All the candidates will have to do is come up with a new Chicago anthem, since the official contest to find one has gone through 1,500 entries since September with no luck and has been extended until June. Candidates must sing a cappella, and only music critics will be allowed to cover it. Number 3. The clean plate debate. Everyone over to my mom's for a soul food dinner of greens, cornbread, and chitlins. Translation, chitterlings. Again, no candidate will be required to talk, since it's impolite to do so with your mouth full. Besides, mom having fattened up everyone and bored them with the family albums will give a good piece of her mind on every issue from garbage collection, which she is for, to the CTA, which she is against. To those who think this format gives Harold Washington an unfair advantage, I also propose two other neighborhood debates and ethnic food bake-offs. One will be in Marquette Park, if Washington is allowed to speak and eat first, and race out 10 minutes ahead of the picnickers. The other will be in Pusinski Country on the northwest side, granted the Char Nina is served hot. In all fairness, the next debate will be in an Irish neighborhood, City Hall. Number 4, the musical chair debate. Each candidate will sit and pose for the cameras at the desk in the mayor's office on the fourth floor. This will allow the public not only to decide which candidate is more mayoral sounding, but which is more mayoral looking. All media will be allowed, since they normally prefer to hang out there rather than travel to a neighborhood. Wait a minute, scratch this debate. Mayor Byrne says she will not allow anyone into her office under any circumstances, even if she loses the primary. They'll just have to carry her out with the furniture if they dare. I have plans for 57 more debates. Give or take a few, but would not disclose any details until I get an agreement on the above, in blood, with a check for $1,000 from each campaign to cover my mom's grocery bill. Anyone interested in co-sponsoring these debates can write me at the Tribune or meet me at my mom's for Sunday dinner. February 18th, 1983. Fear of post-election theft. Forget for a moment the political aides and bravado and the voter registration numbers game. Since the Democratic mayoral primary is nothing but speculation and guesswork now anyway, assume it's the morning of February 23rd and Harold Washington has won. Now what? He becomes mayor, right? Yes, it's tradition, said one longtime political watcher who was white. The winner of the Democratic primary is mayor, whatever else people in this town may be, they're Democrats. A lot of people in the black community think the answer is not so clear. No way, said a Washington backer. Harold is going to win the primary, but they'll find some way to steal the mayor's office. Look, they wouldn't let Wilson Frost have it for 5 minutes. You think they're going to let Harold have it for 4 years? They'll think of something. This sentiment is more widespread than anyone, especially blacks, would like to admit. If this is the case, though, why is there a Washington campaign at all? Why would supporters think Washington could win the primary, yet maintain that he won't become mayor? How could blacks be so skeptical, even as they stand at the threshold of what could be their greatest political coup? The logic is simple. Blacks have learned from history to be eternal optimists and eternal pessimists simultaneously. It was a way to survive. The first quality has helped a race of people confront adversity. It is the fuel of the Washington Crusade, and it is as much crusade as campaign. The second quality has helped a race of people endure adversity. It is the safety valve blacks can turn when all their hopes are dashed, and it has been much used. Optimism says integration can and should work. Pessimism says whites just don't want you next door. Optimism says the progress of the 60s is astounding and will continue. Pessimism says it was so astounding that whites want it cut off. The psychology draws from the old proverb, look for the best, expect the worst. What it says about the despair black Chicagoans feel regarding race relations is revealing. Blacks in their eternal optimism had hoped they were finally fully accepted. Now in their eternal pessimism, they can admit they are not. And the campaign has opened white eyes to this, too. With even old-time liberal friends discerning them from other candidates, many blacks have a circle-the-wagons mentality that makes speculation run wild that anything could happen, including the theft of a primary victory. The suspicions cannot be discounted. Blacks have always had good reason to look over their shoulders. So if Washington wins, many are forced to ask, would Republican candidate Bernard Epton become the Great White Hope? Even a Southwest Side machine alderman thinks so. If Washington wins, then Bernie Epson becomes mayor. White ethnics just aren't ready for a black mayor. It will be interesting, won't it? A black and a Jew? What would be more interesting is that Epton might be persuaded to step aside for a Democrat in Republican clothing, like Richard Ogilvie, whom the machine and white ethnics could better abide. Without doubting Epton's stick-to-itiveness, by the logic of black pessimism, this scheme is not illogical or implausible, and it is legally possible. If Epton withdrew, the Republican committeemen only need vote a replacement. But suppose the political watcher is right, that Chicagoans are Democrats first. Will the machine embrace Washington or co-opt him? From a goodly distance, of course. It did Mayor Byron. 4 years ago, she was as much an outsider as Washington is and was given the same odds, but she's not black. This is the likeliest scenario, knowing that the name of the game in this town is staying in power. Good Democrats all, they will fall in line with Washington, whether they were in the Daley or Byron camp, but the city council will suddenly acquire a mind of its own for the first time to make Washington's term difficult. If the party doesn't rally around Washington, then you may as well throw the party away, said a black machine alderman. Milton Rakoff, University of Illinois at Chicago, political science and a historian who has written 2 books on the machine, agrees. I know that this race is a battle line in this town, but this is a very practical city. The machine learned to live with blacks, and it will learn to live with Washington, and he'll learn to live with them. Yet the logical pessimism forces many blacks to ponder the most far-fetched alternatives, including that whites in this town would indeed throw the party and the fairness away to keep a black man from gaining power. There are mumblings that, just before the April election, Washington could be disqualified on a technicality or tainted in a maliciously invented scandal. Anything to force another election. Even though the filing date is passed for a third-party candidate, the logic of black pessimism says there's a machine hack lurking somewhere ready to pose as one. If the rules can be bent. Just how severe is the distrust? Even the idea of metropolitan government is being whispered, that whites will seriously seek mergers with close-in suburbs to buoy white voter strength and make sure Washington will be the first and last black mayor. The presupposed scheme do not have to be practical. How many suburbs, for example, would want to annex themselves to the city? That these imagined fears are outstripping reason in proof of the depth of pessimism in the black community and of the gulf that remains between the races. To think such thoughts is not to underestimate the political savvy of Washington. It is only to beware of the political treachery of others and not to get caught optimistically off guard. Would those true white liberal friends, those who are expected to vote for Washington, be willing to storm City Hall if it appeared a fix were in to foil him? Blacks would like to think so, if for no other reason than those high-minded soundings about protecting the Democratic right to vote. That is optimism speaking. Yet blacks can be certain of nothing in life except uncertainty. And that, particularly in Chicago, Real friends are outnumbered by real enemies. That is the voice of pessimism. If anything, Washington's campaign has been a great liberating force. It has brought many blacks and whites to reality about the frailty of racial progress, and it has emancipated some whites from the bondage of fashionable pretense and allowed them to be public bigots again. March 30th, 1983, The Wart on Chicago's Face, An Extended Observation of the Ways and Works of Man, from the four-mile radius roughly to the plains of Hindustan. I have drunk with mixed assemblies, seen the racial ruction rise, and the men of half creation damning half creation's eyes. I have watched them in their tantrums, all that Pentecostal crew, French, Italian, Arab, Spaniard, Dutch and Greek and Russian Jew, Celt and savage, buff and ochre, cream and yellow, mauve and white. But it never really mattered till the English grew polite. Et Donna Ferentes, Rudyard Kipling. I hate to tell you so, but I told you so. Right here in this space before the primary election was detailed the injury to race relations and the capacity for dirty tricks that black Chicagoans feared if Harold Washington won the primary. Among them were A. Bernard Epton will become the great white hope. B. The Democratic Party would embrace Washington from a distance of 50 yards. It's more like 100. C. Washington would be smeared. D. Epton might be persuaded to withdraw and let someone else on the ballot. Score 10 extra points for the plot. Only 5 for thinking it might be Richard Ogilvy rather than Jane Byrne. And E, whites would go so far as to promote a metropolitan government to ensure they would outweigh the growing black population and votes in perpetuity. Check all but the last, but took some stretching of the imagination and might take some more time. But the conduct of the principal players in this campaign begs the question of what is unthinkable. The brief interlude provided by Mayor Jane Byrne's write-in campaign would have been unthinkable were it not for the source. There was more to her move than obstinacy, egomanical self-delusion, and greed, although those were quite enough. Perhaps now she will salvage what grace and money she has left and go weigh veggies at the Randolph Street Market, or teach urban studies at Varap College, her alma mater, or open a boutique with her daughter. But in deadly seriousness, the happenings since the primary and Byrne's announcement and re-announcement validate the worst suspicions of blacks. To dwell on whether Byrne would have hurt Epton or whether she could have won missed the point. Her selfish intent was plain, and so was the public sentiment that fed it, to ensure at any cost that Chicago would not have a black mayor. Blacks told you so. Like the English in Kipling's poem, blacks grew polite. They became, as the poem continues, the men who fight with votes. Then did trouble arise. It matters not that after years of being labeled apathetic, blacks turned out not just to register to vote, but actually to vote when the numbers really counted. It matters not that Washington won with numbers. It matters not that there is a genuine race for this town to erase its ugliest wart. It matters not how well-spoken or well-educated the candidate is, how moderate, how open. All that matters in this town is what color one is. It is positively antebellum. Who is doing the polarizing? Whites who are all but packed up to leave town after years of running everything, or blacks who, after years of voting for white politicians, could get neither thanks nor dividends for their investment in other stock, and the stock lies, except by putting forth their own candidate. Now having won, and with only themselves to thank for it, blacks don't even merit a moment to savor their prize because of the plots to foil it. What is it that makes Chicago so shamelessly bigoted? There are bigots everywhere, but what makes being a bigot more respectable here? With more than 200 black mayors nationwide, what makes the thought of the same here so distasteful? Could it be that whites think blacks now will give them equal opportunity at unfairness? Mindless hatred requires an evaluation more penetrating than merely looking at quaint neighborhood ethnicity. Though it cannot be coincidence that the runner-up for lousy race relations is Boston. While greed is the descending factor in the Three Stooges' antics of the ward bosses, what is it that motivates people with no vested interest, no city job, to curl their lips and spit epithets at black children? Is it crime? Then blacks have the stronger case for anger, being victimized twice, first by the criminal and then by the criminal lack of police concern. Is it primordial xenophobia? Is it unforgivable simply to write all of this off as just the way things are? Lively politics make for great news stories, but there is no humor beneath it all. This town is beset by a wrenched plague. Chicagoans with any soul left to search should be asking themselves why.
And that will do us for this week. We will pick up there next Friday, same time, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. Folks have comments that they would like to get in before we wrap things up. We have roughly 30 minutes remaining in the program. The number to dial, 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press *6 if you would like to participate. All the folks who dialed in with a hand up, if y'all have comments, feel free. Please do not wait till the last minute. If you are listening and you haven't commented and you think, you know, there's something that you want to add, go ahead, get your hand up. We will make sure that you get an opportunity to speak before we wrap up. But please do not wait until we get to the bottom of the hour and decide that you got, you know, a few sentences that you have got to express. So we should have Thomas in New York, Roz, retired firefighter, our female caller 9401, and I think Karma, you all should all be with us. If you all have commentary, feel free.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes. Yeah, my commentary was pretty quick. First, I wanted to, if there's time, I wanted to make a comment on the white validation point. But the statement she made, I think it was, I don't have the book, but blacks are extreme pessimists, extreme optimists at the same time. Is that the direct quote for Gus? Or?
I think that's in the fear of post-election theft. And she says it a few different ways. Let's see, the sentiment... The logic is simple. Blacks have learned from history to be eternal optimists and eternal pessimists simultaneously. Eternal. It is our way to survive. Is that enough?
Yeah, that was a very interesting statement. I'm going to have to ponder on that. Very interesting. Wow. And, yeah, everything she wrote about the Harry Washington election and the fears and, you know, what whites were trying to do. I mean, it brought me right back to 2008. It was just like, wow. I mean, they played the same game, or not game, but they used the same racist tactics to
do the same thing to Obama, you know, even up to Reverend Wright. I mean, it was just so much. It was so many layers. Every day on the news, it was something else that, you know, you kind of felt like, oh, this is going to be the thing that's going to keep him out of it. You know, you just had that eternal pessimistic, I guess, attitude, you know, and at the same time, you held on to that optimism, like, if you're going to do it, you know, it's just very, I mean, almost 20-plus years later, everything she described happened in 2008. It's just very compelling, and I'll mute my line on that. Thank you.
I think on that, on President Obama, I think the pessimism was intense enough that I think it was widely speculated that he might be killed to stop him from winning. I think that was widely commented on during that, during the whole run up to him being, you know, and continues to be that he might be killed at some point. And I had a snicker about that because I think some of the people probably on this call have heard Mr. Fuller say that describe himself as an optimistic pessimist and a pessimistic optimist. And he's detailed what that means, but he said that a few times in describing himself.
Oh, and it's funny. I listened to one of I didn't know Mr. Fuller had his own radio show. And I happened to listen to one of the shows in the archive. And he said something that was strange. I mean, this isn't related to the book, but he said Chinese people are black people who white people call Chinese people. And I said, wow, I never thought of it like that.
Right on.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Oh, I'm sorry. You were saying something, Gus?
I just was going to say right on. Proceed.
Oh, okay. I agree. Right on. First, I wanted to touch on what you spoke about right before we went to the second segment in regards to our white validation. I thought it brought, I thought the sister who first brought up the subject was very accurate, and I thought that you expounding further on it the way you did, speaking to the difference between being forced or through the system to have to get white validation for daily life essentials versus consciously seeking white validation to bolster your feeling that white people like you or are going to treat you like a human being. I thought that that was extremely accurate because, in my opinion, just from experience, it's like, to me, it's a form of sanity. Just in the sense that if you go from a situation where you're at a job and you're forced to work with white people, so like she said, you have to get their validation as to whether you're doing the job correct or just to get a paycheck and all of that. But yet, like for me, when I leave the job, white people don't get any help from me. I don't hold doors for them. I stay as far away from them as possible. So to me, there has to be a higher level of understanding of the system in order to function like that, where you're not seeking white validation on a daily basis as far as going out to be pleasant to them and so-called making white friends and things of that nature. So I just thought that was, both of you brought up very brilliant points as far as the sister originally bringing out the idea and then you expounding on it. My comments in reference to the book on page 77, it's actually you started that session where she said the logic is simple. Blacks have learned from history to be eternal optimists and eternal pessimists simultaneously. It was a way to survive. The first quality was has helped a race of people confront adversity. It is the fuel of the Washington Crusade. And it is as much crusade as campaign. The second quality has helped a race of people endure adversity. It is the safety valve blacks can turn when all their hopes are dashed. And I took that to mean when white supremacy is practiced on black people. It has been much used. Optimism says integration can and should work. I believe that's an inaccuracy of perception of the system. Pessimism says whites just don't want you next door. That is accurate. It's like she's going accurate to inaccurate to accurate. Optimism says the progress of the 60s is astounding and will continue. Pessimism says it's so astounding whites want it cut off. So there you can see just pointedly in that one paragraph just how she seesaws back and forth between having an accurate understanding in certain aspects and then making errors in her perception in others. Briefly on the following page 78, she wrote, yet the logic of pessimism forces many blacks to ponder the most far-fetched alternatives, including that whites in this town would indeed throw the party and fairness away to keep a black man from gaining power. It's almost like she's labeling it almost in a borderline of calling it paranoia, like where black people are pondering the most far-fetched alternatives, but yet it's so accurate because white people will go to any extreme, including that, in order to keep a black man from gaining power, if not kill him to do so, like you mentioned with President Obama. So, again, it just shows how confusing the system can be. And then on the following page 79, she said, if anything, Washington's campaign has been a great liberating force. It has brought many blacks and whites to the reality about the frailty of racial progress. It has emancipated some whites from the bondage of fashionable pretense and allowed them to be the public, public bigots again. This really makes me think of the Donald Trump era. I call him the resurrection of Ben Tillman, because that's exactly the climate that we're functioning in now, and it kind of speaks to what Thomas in New York spoke about earlier when he was saying that essentially right now this climate, what she described then about Mayor Washington is exactly what we experienced in 2008. And then in this paragraph, she was describing the climate and atmosphere that was surrounding the Honorable Mr. Washington and now surrounds the entire country around Donald Trump and his campaign for the presidency. And I'll mute my line there. Thank you.
Let's see.
Hello?
Yes, ma'am. We can hear you.
May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am. We can hear you.
Oh, great. There's a storm. Yes, I found it was really good. The part, I was really interested in the part where she said, wow, you know, we elected him and we did it all on our own. Black people who had been apathetic, registered to vote and voted and put him in office. We did it all by ourselves with no one else. And I have said this many, many times. One, I don't think any white people voted for President Obama. I think they're all just lying. They don't act like they voted for President Obama. And it's a normal tactic to say, well, if you lose, you know, it was your fault. You win, it was my fault. It was because of me. I don't think any white people ever voted for any of these black people. And she said it herself. And I think that is so important because just as white people have systematically padded their numbers, you know, now the Jews are white, you know, now all of the Hispanics, you know, are white, I think that they have, more than we can even imagine, cut back our numbers. I think our numbers are much greater in this country, the U.S., whatever they're calling it, than anything on the census that we're seeing. I think our numbers are still pretty phenomenal because they certainly wouldn't be this tense all the time if our numbers weren't phenomenal. So that's one thing. And the other thing, it's like, this is something else I learned in college. The logic. How can you be an optimist and a pessimist at the same time? You cannot be an optimist and a pessimist at the same time. You can only do what the caller said before. You can swing wildly back and forth. And that is so destabilizing to anyone's psyche. And the reason she's doing that is because she was refusing to take this logically and be accurate. So she's saying, one minute, I'll just be optimistic. But it's just something she made up in her head. And the next minute, oh, I'm so pessimistic. That's another thing she made up in her head. But we should be fact-based. We should use data, and we should make good decisions based on that good data. And there's no reason for us to be wildly optimistic or pessimistic. We can just be on our job. We can just stay on task given the fact that we have data. We don't have to engage in all of that emotional pendulum stuff that completely destabilizes anyone. So I think that was another thing that contributed, you know, to her true suffering. She just didn't want to accept any facts, you know. She just really didn't. So, my opinion.
For sure. Hang on one second, because I think our narrator is with us as well. Our narrator, who was gracious enough to invest some time to do the reading for us this week. Did you have any comments you wanted to add in?
Yes, yes, thank you. I'm so happy to be on the line tonight. Thank you, Gus, for having me as narrator, and thank you for all the comments and listeners on the line tonight. I just did want to make a brief comment on the section, The Wart on Chicago's Face. When I was reading that section and going over it again tonight, I could feel her pain and, you know, how she really, you know, realized the, you know, what was going on in her city. And the section on the, one of the last paragraphs where she says, mindless hatred requires an evaluation more penetrating than merely looking at the quaint neighborhood ethnicity, though it cannot be coincidence that the runner-up for this lousy race relations is Boston. And knowing, you know, the history of Boston and how bigoted they are there, and to make that comparison to her hometown, that just brought a realistic view of what she saw at that moment during these races. And another point that really struck me was the last part where it says, it is unforgivable simply to write all of this off as just the way things are. Lively politics make for great news stories, but there's no humor beneath it all. This town is beset by a wretched plague. And that brings it to mind today of what's going on politically today and this circus of debates and political races that's going on. And, you know, all these bigoted remarks and that's just thrown out there is, oh, that's just politics. And, you know, it just showed the pain to me. It showed the pain that she was going through, seeing and realizing the struggle of racism and white supremacy that was going on, you know, right in her own backyard, that maybe she just, you know, at some point she didn't want to admit and didn't want to see, but this brought it home to her. And knowing that, yes, this is happening and, you know, this is something that we have to deal with, but how do we? Thank you for taking my comment.
Thank you. Appreciate that. And again, thank you for doing the heavy lifting and doing the reading for us this week. Before I get to anybody else, Thomas, did you have a quick comment that you were going to get in before we nab the other folks?
Yes, I just was going to say to Thomas that when Obama won the presidency, he received 69,500,000 votes, and it's only 40 million black people in the whole country. So, and of course, just said it on a voting age, and one out of four black men can't vote because of the felony. So, there's no way he could have got the presidency without a huge amount of black, white people voting for him. And I think that's like the ultimate show of their refinery, and also the show of their power. If they could put a black man in that position, and he still can't do nothing for black people, just to show the world, you know. But it's no way he could have got in that position. Nor could have a Washington have, looking at the demographics of Chicago, without a huge amount of whites voting for.
Anybody that we missed who had commentary they wanted to make sure they got in? Anybody that we missed hasn't commented at all after the second audio clip? Okay, so we got everybody. Does the name Rudyard Kipling, does that mean anything to anybody here?
Isn't that Tarzan? Tarzan?
Jungle Book, same thing, yeah.
Jungle Book, that little boy, yeah.
And absolutely.
Is white. He racist? That's a white person, right?
Yes, he is. White man's burden, that mean anything to anybody? White man's burden? It's a poem Rudyard Kipling.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Hmm. Yeah. No, I was going to say yes. I was just trying to remember it because I haven't read it in so long. But yes, as soon as you said the title, I said, oh, yeah, I remember that. But it's just I'm having a brain fart in the moment. Excuse my description, but I'm trying to pull it up and then I'll comment. But yes, as soon as you said the title, it stood out immediately.
Right on. That's the poem that she starts off the essay on, where she's talking about the fears of black people in Chicago. They're, I guess, possible paranoia about what might happen if Harold Washington wins, and all of that. The wart on Chicago's face is Rudyard Kipling, which I thought was interesting. Once again, where these I don't know who I could compare him to of today. I don't know. There's no current racist poet, and it would have to be somebody who is writing specifically poetry and literature. Racist poetry and racist literature. There's nobody I can think of a 21st century comparison, but like, this guy is worshipped. If you go through the Ivory Towers, the Academy, particularly if you do some sort of like English major or literature major, they are going to stuff Rudyard Kipling down your throat. You're going to have to read lots and lots of that stuff. So I thought that was profound that this black female journalist, and particularly writing this passage about racism, white supremacy, and black people being terrorized in Chicago, that she references some of the work of Rudyard Kipling. And I think Rudyard Kipling is like one of the few whites that most white people would not challenge you on. If you said this guy is a racist and he wrote like proudly with regards to his stance on white supremacy, most white people would not challenge you. They would have no problem saying, oh yeah, that guy, Rudyard Kipling, oh yeah, he was a race, white, like I said, White Man's Burden and the stuff he wrote with Jungle Book, that sort of thing. They would just look at his body of work and even the poem that she includes here. I agreed with the commentary that you all kind of made about, I guess this is the pre, and I guess keeping in mind the dates, so we reset in terms of the dates where we were progressing, because we were on into 84 with some of the essays. So now the new section that we're in, that's politics, the date reset. So these essays are mostly like the early part of 1983. So this is like a year and a half, a little less than a year and a half before her suicide, and about 3 months from her essay, How Chicago Taught Me to Hate Whites. And it might be interesting to look at particularly the wart on Chicago's face and fear of post-election theft, where she's talking about, and it almost at times sounds like paranoia, like black people having all these kind of nutty concerns about what whites might do to smear Harold Washington or what have you. And I think she's just trying to explain these maybe for some white readers, why black people might have some of these fears, some of this pessimism. But it turns out if you fast forward 3 months down the line, it seems like a lot of this stuff did come to bear in terms of the way that white people conducted themselves throughout the election process. And then even once Harold Washington, this black male, did become the first mayor of Washington, it seems like a lot of what she calls pessimism, white people did go ahead and follow through on all that with their racist and tacky conduct. And it seems to have contributed mightily to the demise in her mental health. But I would just kind of encourage folks to kind of pay attention to that as we move along with the dates. I didn't quite know what to make the New Sparks and Forensics Fire. That was the essay before those two, where she's talking about the debate and kind of giving some of her, I think they're unrealistic. I think she's being satirical, a little bit funny, where she's talking about having dinner at her mom's house and all this, as opposed to a debate or having a sing-off for a new Chicago song. I didn't quite know how to take all of that, because this seems so, particularly with how serious things got by the time you get to the essay on How Chicago Taught Me to Hate Whites, for this one to kind of be a bit not so serious. I didn't, at least to me, it didn't come across as being that serious in what she was suggesting here. Not that, you know, you can't have an essay where you're just being, I'm poking some fun at all of this madness that's going on, but I didn't quite know how to, what to make of that one. I didn't want to gloss over the fact, the introduction to that essay, New Sparks in Forensics Fire. Marquette Park is an all-white Southwest Side neighborhood whose level of racial tolerance was indicated by its being the home of Chicago's neo-Nazi party until the organization's leader was convicted of child molestation. These perversions of the white race, their culture of rape and all sorts of sexual deviance. I did not want to gloss over that either before we move forward. And I also thought it was important as well, because I think one of the things that was noted was that whites were going to conspire to make sure that Chicago never had another black mayor, even though they have a sizable portion of black people, even though it has been dropping. And that's also a part of deliberate racist act. But they, I do not think, I don't live in Chicago, I don't live in Illinois, but unless I'm incorrect, they have not had another black mayor since Harold Washington, unless I'm in error. Other folks have commentary they want to get in?
Hi. Yes, I had a quick comment on white validation, and I just wanted to make it real quick because I think that a lot was described, I don't consider that to be white validation. That's just white supremacy. You got to go to a white person for a job, you got to go to a white person for a loan. You know, I describe white supremacy as black people who display symptoms of, you know, like a disease or addiction of having to constantly be validated by white people. And I consider them to be extremely dangerous. And, you know, usually I associate this with, like, people who uphold the system, like cops or politicians or athletes, entertainers, you know, who got to get that constant, you know. But most specifically, people in tragic arrangements, because they get it every day through affection and conversations and, you know, sex. And also to hear they love them from a white person, I mean, that has to be very confusing. And what I find, people that suffer from white validation are the people that will never understand the system. That's what I usually mean when I say it.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
I agree. I totally agree. I thought that was a brilliant assessment, and it really made me think a little bit differently, but it still makes sense. White validation is basically a subset of white supremacy and how it manifests itself, so it makes total sense. There was something that you talked about, I believe it was last week when we did the reading, about how when black people go through white supremacist terrorism, we don't stay angry for long, and in time, eventually that anger will subside and you'll kind of go back to your regular everyday, you know, mannerisms and feelings. And to me, what I like about the fact that you give the dates of these pieces and telling us how close they were to her death versus where they were during the time frame that she wrote How Chicago Taught Me to Hate Whites, you can see that those pieces that are closer to that time frame when she wrote that How to Hate Whites piece, the anger was still there. So there was it seems to be she exhibited more understanding. And then as we were reading pieces closer to her death, you see more of the mental illness and the confusion. So I'm really happy that you're giving us that juxtaposition of time frame, because it really helps to solidify just how ill she was and what she was suffering from. Also, I believe that she when she writes about the paranoia of black people and us thinking of these outlandish ideas, and the fact that you just said, which is highly accurate, that a lot of what she wrote about and discussed came to fruition, I think that really speaks to a big part of our problem as black people and all non-white people, is that white people are capable of doing anything. And black people have, at least when dealing with non-black people, we have a limit to how far we will concede to do harm to other people. But they don't have a limit because of white genetic annihilation, their fear of that. And the only people that black people do not have a limit with assaulting or abusing are other black people. We'll go do the most heinous things to one another, but we'll be highly restrained whenever white people disrespect us or do things overtly to terrorize us. And to me, that just really speaks to the fact that we as black people really don't conceive of how far white people will go, which is as far as possible, because like any living organism, if they feel their existence is threatened, they're going to do anything by any means necessary to survive. And if we can get that through our heads, it would give us a huge boost in understanding the system and how it works, And that kind of really, that her speaking about paranoia, and that paranoia is actually a healthy paranoia because it helps us to understand that whenever we conceive of the worst thing that a white person can do, we have to psychologically go past the worst thing to even get close to what they're capable of doing. And I'll mute my line.
I think Dr. Kamal Cambon, I think he stated on the program that white people's capacity for evil is not in their past, it is in their future. And I think he says that just so that we get that in mind. Whatever vile things that racists have done or doing to us, that is not the limit with regards to what they can and are willing to do to black people, non-white people worldwide. We have like 60 seconds left. Anybody have a quick comment they wanted to make sure they got in before we wrap this week's session up?
Well, don't you think that it's deep-rooted that we do know what they're capable of? I think only us in the Europeans who kick them out know what these people are capable of. And that's why when we will go all out on each other, but we know that the second we do something to them, it's going to be consequences and repercussions, and we won't do it. And I always use the analogy, I live in Harlem, and these white girls will walk around here with a mini skirt and high heels, walk in their little door at 2 o'clock in the morning, and no one's even thinking about doing anything to them because they know that, you know, it's going to be solved. That case will be solved. They will be punished for that crime. Whereas if they do something to a black person, you know, that case might not be solved. But we know what the white people are capable of. That's why we don't do too much.
I guess I would only say quickly, I think that is totally logical. It makes perfect sense. I think we have an understanding that white people can do a lot of damage to us. In terms of the depths of what they can do, I don't think most of us really process that on a regular basis. I know, and I can just put it to myself specifically. I think at some level, consciously, subconsciously, myself and most of us, whether we study racism or not, have an understanding, yeah, white people can do a lot of damage to you. They can make things very difficult for you. But in terms of how that translates to the individual whites that we are around, I don't think that that translates at all. And how just the individual whites that we are around participate in that and or allow it, even if they're not directly participating in it. And in terms of what that can involve, not just they can end up making problems for you, but this could end up being something that ends up making problems for all of the black people in this part of the world, whether it's this particular area of town, this entire city, this entire state, like the grand scale of damage that white people can do to black people. I don't think most black people really grasp that. Even though I do, like if we want to take AIDS, for example, I think there are a good number of black people who might say that, yeah, they think that could be a conspiracy. They may give that some credence or what have you. But even if you take something, as I would say, more in your face every day than AIDS, when Roz brought up the statistic about 70% of the teachers are white females, I don't think most of us connect those white females being in the classroom and the damage that they're doing to black people. Even what I said earlier when I said those white women, those white female teachers are at the center of what they call the prison, school to prison pipeline. I don't think most of us connect that and say, and not only is that what's happening, but this is being done deliberately, that this is not a case of they're just culturally incompetent, they're just ignorant, they just need some cultural sensitivity classes, and these white chicks will be great in the classroom, and we won't have this problem anymore. That, no, this is just a part of their ongoing strategy for how they practice racism, white supremacy. I don't think most of us grasp the depth in terms of them having a long-range strategy for what they're going to be doing to us, and how just the little white teacher in the classroom, because that's a section that's coming up in the book. I don't even think it's next week. It's down the road. She has a whole section that's on the Chicago public school system. But I don't think we grasp it in that sense. I could be wrong, and we can talk about it on the compensatory call-in tomorrow. But folks can ponder on it. If I'm talking crazy, you can feel free to let me know tomorrow. Or you can drop an email, Gus, you're talking crazy, and, you know, point out the flaws. Thank you to all the folks who chimed in, participated. I hope it was a constructive investment of your Friday evening. We will be back tomorrow for the compensatory call-in, 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific. Feel free, workplace racism, news clips, observations from the last 7 days. Sunday is our global Sunday talk on racism. Obviously, that is the early program time, 12 noon Eastern, 9 a.m. Pacific. Looking forward to hearing from folks who are in different parts of the world, hearing what they have to say, their observations. We'll get caught up. That'll be this coming Sunday. If you have gripes, complaints, suggestions, other commentary, drop an email, untiljustice@gmail.com. Untiljustice@gmail.com. With that, we will be back in about 24 hours. I will say again, sobriety would be best under conditions of white terrorism. You do not want to be intoxicated if you are the driver, passenger, pedestrian. You never know when it's going to be Daniel Holtzclaw, Darren Wilson, who ends up pulling up behind you. Whites can ruin your life in a matter of seconds. We want to make sure that we are clear thinking, lucid at all times, so we can make great decisions, do the best that we can to keep ourselves as safe as possible under extremely vile conditions, and anybody else that we might be responsible for. With that, again, happy birthday, Dr. Frances Cress Welsing. Keep her in your thoughts for the weekend. With that, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim, your brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
Man, I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.